The following contains strong language, violence, and nudity. It is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
Welcome to the Spawnometer!
And we actually have a fucking Spawnometer this time. Shot, horse.
Two men enter, one man leave.
The last time we had seen a Spawnometer was in issue 22, and the count was at 7864. By the time we saw another Spawnometer last issue, 26, it was at 7174. So that's a pretty big jump from 78 to 71. A huge amount of his power has disappeared. That happens on the same page where they were talking about what happened to Violator, where Spawn had given us some his power to Violator to give him his demonic form back, and then Violator kicked him off a fucking roof and bailed, and then supposedly he'd come back and actually gave him the power, which we never saw in the comic books before that moment. And the Spawnometer is before the little line that says 2 days later, so I'm wondering if Spawn had used up enough power to like stop that car to drop from 7-8 to 7-1, which doesn't make sense to me. What makes more sense to me is that he gave that hunk of power to revive the Violator demon, and that perhaps Violator gave him some pittance of that power back, but I'll too stupid to realize he stole like a whole chunk of his power and kept that shit. That's the best thing I can determine.
Okay. So this is just cursed?
Yeah, the story is cursed. It's by Todd McFarlane and Greg Capullo with thanks to Kevin Conrad. And I think what that thinks is that I think Kevin Conrad inked the vast majority of this issue because it looks a lot different to me, to my eye, from the previous issue that was all McFarlane's inking.
Oh, no, it definitely did.
Yeah,
you and can it's tell. Dedicated to?
John Buscema or Buscema. I've never been 100% on what the pronunciation is. You're familiar with this gentleman, though.
Yes. I collected some of his Incredible Hulk artwork, which is phenomenal.
Was it John or was it Sal?
I think I have John and Sal.
Who do you prefer?
Ooh.
I'm going to tell you straight up. For me, Sal Buscema is the Hulk artist of the two.
You think so? The old school?
I think that John does some great Hulk images. I'm not trying to diminish him in any way. He's one of the great comic book artists of all time and really underappreciated. He just doesn't come up enough in conversations for how great he was and what a huge influence he was in, especially the Bronze Age and all the artists that came out of the Bronze Age. But Sal just gave you that the more immense Hulk, the more fierce Hulk, crazier, scarier Hulk. And he just put in the years, man. Sal put in years on the Hulk. So you got to respect that.
That's a hard one for me, man.
I'm sorry. I'm proud of you for having pages of either one of those guys. I think that you got those in the early days of eBay, and I bet you fucking scored big time. I bet you that shit's worth a lot of money.
I mean, I collected even, you know, lesser known artists. I caught a couple of my holy grails. I'm still to this day upset that I missed out on paying $136 for a fucking Mike Mignola Hulk cover. Or not cover. It was a
splash,
like
a splash page,
kind of, but it wasn't a full splash page. There was just a small image of the Hulk in the corner. I gotta find the issue again. It's I want to say it's the one where he goes into the green world. I can't remember, but
it's still Mike Mignola drawing the Hulk.
The guy had it. The guy put it up. I used to look at the Hulk page every, you know, the eBay Hulk awkward every morning when I'd wake up, and the guy had it for buy now $130 plus shipping, and I'm like, I'll check on it maybe later. I come back and it was gone in a heartbeat.
Do you own any Mike Mignola?
No. I got most of the artists that I like from that time period. That was the only one. I could have got it for like $150 probably with shipping.
And see, I could
add that to my collection.
But you do have John Buscema, who's no longer with us, and you bought that.
John, I have a Sal, Tex Avery, Gene Ha, lots of fucking John McCrae. But you've seen my collection, dude.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, you managed to get John Buscema pages when he was still with us, probably for a pretty reasonable price. And I think I paid
like $80 for him.
Yeah, I bet you that. I haven't looked at John Buscema prices these days, but those are probably worth hundreds of dollars at least at this point.
Oh, by now, yeah. Because the pages I have are full Hulk pages, splash Hulk page in the center. I think Nightmare's in the background. Yeah, these are...
That might be four figures, man. For John Buscema, you know? I mean, he put out a lot of pages.
It's fucking beautiful.
Yeah.
Dude, my Del Quiones, those are the ones I hate because the Del Quiones are so beautiful in the front, and he did all that sketchwork in the back, so you have to flip them to enjoy like all the extra little shit. I guess he was just playing with his pencils, and he's sketching characters in the back of the artwork, and I'm just like, oh, I can't turn these forward and back. The Del Quiones are great. My Mike Cohen is pretty good, but that's a Superman. Even the fucking Perez. Do you still have yours?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's my Twitter icon.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. So, yeah.
But anyway, back to 26. You're talking about the cover.
Yes. So it kind of caught me off guard. When I first looked, I'm like, wait, did he shoot himself? And then I realized, no, it's just a huge hole in his chest. So and it's very distinctive.
But also,
you have this huge splatter shot in the background. It definitely caught my attention.
Green blood splatter.
We went from Spawn in the swamp to Spawn dead in an alley. But of course, this was a prelude to what was going to happen in the book. So
this was released on February the 2nd, 1995, which was typical for the 5-ish week schedule of Spawn coming out. Angela had apparently kept a better schedule. And so the third issue was out just a few weeks later, the same month. Also that month, Aunt May's Best Death appeared in Amazing Spider-Man number 400. We got The Flash number 100 back in the olden days when you could get to a 100th issue of a comic book. Preacher number 1 was out that same month.
Which I bought from you.
Yeah. You probably bought my copy that I... you might have gotten my copy. I'm not sure. Because I sold my copy of Preacher number 1 eventually at that same shop. I don't remember the finer details, though. And then finally, Bar Sinister was released at Valiant at the same time that Shaman's Tears was still coming out at Image, and they shared continuity. They had been introduced in Shaman's Tears number 1. So it just goes to show you that they'd already basically fired those second-tier creators, but because of some certain allowances, they were actually managing to compete with each other by having the same material at two different companies.
So in this issue, we're introduced to a character who, I guess he's being guided by deities or some kind of holy power, because he seems to know about Spawn. But I mean, anyway, I'm sorry. So he's loading up. We see this man in a cloak loading up weapons, driving, getting onto a plane, flying to the city. The cabbie's talking to him. A drunk's talking to him. A prostitute who looks like Harley Quinn is talking to him.
A little bit older Harley Quinn, you know, after
really, really rough years for Harley there. And he goes into an alleyway where Spawn is now picking up the body of, I thought it was Bootsy.
No, Bootsy is the guy with the ball cap on. He's one of the buddies. Okay. But he's talking to Bootsy about Bobby.
Okay, so I misread that. So this character's been, the character that was shot in the head during his encounter with Chapo is laying there dead. And Spawn is actually generally showing empathy. He feels sad. He feels like he's bringing all this upon them. But they're still, they got his back. They're like, we're not going to, you know, we still got you. And he feels horrible. And they're like, can you do anything? And he's like, I don't know. Let me see what I can do. And he rises.
Yeah, it's interesting because the guys in the alley are actually telling Spawn there isn't anything you can do. We understand this shit happens. And it's Spawn who's tenderly holding Bobby by the back of the neck, who won't let him stay dead. And he's the one who decides to use some of his power. Even they're like, dude, doesn't that hurt you? And he's like, yes, but I have to do it. Live!
And the dude just like pops up like nothing. At least leave the hole in his head, dude.
Well, he did have the blood splatter at least.
Bring him back as a zombie, dude. That would have been cool. Like, oh shit, now I'm gonna be the walking dead. I'm like your slave bitch boy now, master. That would have been kind of a funny take on it. But he comes back, but apparently this drains Spawn to what? 7012?
Yeah, and again, he was at 7174. So for resurrecting the very dead, that's not a lot of power to have had to use. So I don't know how he could have lost so much power between 22 and 26 without the whole Lazarus shit.
It depends on how fresh the corpse is.
Maybe,
fresh
or the degree corpse, of damage.
Not as much power. You know, he tries to bring back, you know, someone who's been dead for a couple of years. Takes a lot more power to regenerate them. Now, what's kind of cool is if what's his name comes back and he's actually just Plasm now. He's not really alive. It's just Plasm that moving his corpse around, pretending to be alive. It's fucking weird.
Feel like you have to have some sort of consequence to this. If they don't explore the consequence of resurrecting Bobby,
like there's a demon in him now or
something
like that.
I'm gonna be really disappointed if they don't do something with that. But the other thing that gets me, there's a whole bunch of other dead hobos around there. What the fuck about those guys?
Here we go. You know what happens? The consequence is this character now becomes like a portal to hell, where every night he starts throwing up and little demons are coming out and they use him as a gateway to get out of hell.
It kind of like what they did in Stranger Things season 2. It was like spitting out slugs.
I was thinking of Gateway from the X-Men, like, you know, Gateway spinning his shit to open gateways.
Is he spitting out like slugs? Are they like slug demons?
Yeah. I was thinking the James Gunn movie.
Brightburn? Oh, Slither.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where that chick is like huge and she's like, I don't feel very well. And then boom.
Right. Something. Please. Fuck. Something. Fingers crossed. For fuck's sake. Do something with these products.
That would be kind of cool. Yeah. That's where I was kind of going with it. Next, we're back to the boring part of the story where Wanda and Terry are still trying to figure out what would Jason Wynn involved in. And they're now the heart-to-heart group, you know, party that's being a detective group at night. And one's a government agent and the other was a mother during the day. And yeah. I just didn't particularly care about this.
They got 57 files from Sundin's office. And I don't know who the fuck Sundin is. So that means...
Yeah, just Remington Steel, heart-to-heart, all that shit thrown in it for me. And then all of a sudden we get a boom. And it's a nice clear chest shot to Spawn's chest, blowing his chest out. And we are introduced to Curse.
Yeah, the curse is the religious zealot that flew in from Massachusetts.
Oh, the Curse. I'm sorry, I just called him Curse.
On the toy packaging, I don't know if they use the V or not, but he's definitely...
No, you have to put the the.
I think you do need the
damn
the.
Damn, yeah. That name just doesn't have that same oomph without the
I
the.
Just blew a big ass hole in Spawn. I've earned my the.
Yeah, you have to earn that the. Yeah. It's not just something that's given away.
So this
hey,
is
looks kind of cool though. I mean, I don't know. Ripclaw mixed with somebody from Youngblood mixed with fucking, I don't know. I mean, he has the Spawn boot.
Yeah, he the spike boot and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Which well, Spawn doesn't have yet, right?
No, he's got it at that point. No, maybe not. Maybe he doesn't have it
no,
yet.
No, not yet.
No.
Because I remember that always bothered me in the later issues.
That he stole the his boot from the curse.
Boot right. Made no sense to it made it. It may have turned me off. That's why I stopped reading Spawn.
We'll get to that later. Boot.
But he has, you know, the one big boot with spikes. The other one has like the Wolverine kind of hairdo, and he has cables all over him, and he has, I guess, some kind of power generated gun that lets him launch energy beams. And I mean, for Soso, he's kind of a cool character. He believes he killed the Spawn. He's a little disappointed because he didn't think man-made weapons could do this. So he's a little disappointed that a simple blast of the chest is all it took. So he's walking around, and it's his hubris that's going to bring him down quickly.
Well, and it's not entirely his fault. The guy is clearly a fucking whack job.
And we forgot to mention that there are some homeless men that led him to Spawn.
Mm-hmm.
So not all the homeless people there are appreciative of Spawn.
I like the one guy's like, yeah, this guy's a scab. I like that. That scab is definitely a term that you could apply to Spawn, and it seems very correct.
Yes. We're starting to see more of the world that Spawn is the protector of, and there's two camps, the pro-Spawn, anti-Spawn party. The curse is walking away. The pro-Spawns are, oh my God, he's hurt. Look at the hole in his chest. Let's move him out of the way. And apparently that's when it's introduced that he weighs 500 pounds of concrete. Can't leave him there. And then we're back to fucking Remington Steel, and they're talky-talky about Jason Wynn and how they're going to find him. And, you know, it's all spooky.
Everybody's acting weird around Terry because they were trying to fucking murder him. And now they're like, nothing ever can happen. And he's like, fuck this shit.
And then next we see a police car pulling up through the alleyway, and the police officer's walking up, and they're all, you know, the homeless guys are sitting there hanging out with Spawn. He's like, hey, what's up with your buddy? Oh, he's a real light drinker. Can't really keep up with us. Well, y'all need to get out of the way. I need to drive through this alleyway.
There were reports of gunshots, and this is all happening. Chapel should also be in that alleyway with his fucking head blown off because he was just getting done shooting these guys, and then fucking Curse comes around and shoots some more. So that's what he was investigating.
And so someone screams, gets his attention. He runs away. They talk about how Jimmy really screams like a bloody woman. They're trying to wake up Spawn. They can't get him up. And I guess the curse now is going to tell us about his origin story.
Yeah, well, he took off his armor and he just started, or at least he took off his mask. He's got that cool, weird fucking mask where it looks like he's got no eyes. You know, yeah. it's cut around his mouth, and you can see he's got like a brown colored beard or goatee, like a thick one. And then the rest of the head is just featureless. So he's probably got a HUD like you got with the Iron Man. But since that wasn't something we were used to back then, he just looks like he's got no fucking eyes. But then when he takes the helmet off, you see that he does have two eyes, including like a big, long, deep scar over the right eye. And he's got a cloak on, and he's preaching to the homeless about the Lord, their savior. Like you said, telling his origin story.
No one was making a sacrifice, so he made a sacrifice. He sacrificed his arm, but well, they missed the point of what was the truth.
But his whole thing is that he believes in the divine, and he wants to make a connection with divinity, and he feels like he cannot talk to God. And the whole time throughout the issue, you hear him talking to God, but he never gets a reply. So he's this fanatical believer, but he doesn't actually seem to have a connection. And so he's doing all these things to just get God's attention. He carves out his own eye and leaves a big scar. He chops off his arm. None of that was working. So then this one-armed bastard goes to college and starts a fucking entrepreneurial endeavor that nets him millions and millions of dollars, which I don't know how he managed to sell himself on this shit, because he's just constantly talking God all the time. I mean, I guess maybe he started a ministry somewhere, and that's how he got the fucking private jet. But then he's devoted all of his money to try to reach God, and so he's got this technology that's supposed to help him to do that, these secular tools, and he's hunting Spawn because initially he thinks that Spawn is also connected to the divine, like he's an angel and somebody who could get him closer to God. But once he blows a hole in the dude, he realizes that he's just another agent of Satan. This guy's worthless to me, and just walks away and starts preaching to the homeless people because he's got time to kill, apparently.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden his arm is blown off, his laser arm, and Spawn is quick to remind him that before you walk away, make sure your enemy's dead completely. Otherwise, you'll think you're being chased by a ghost. Then the paranoia starts to eat you alive. And then, you know, he's talking about, oh, my arm, and he tells him to shut up. And Spawn is just fed up with everybody fucking with him at this point. I guess he just had it.
It's been a bad fucking night, for sure.
Yeah, he's just done. He's just having a shitty night.
And he didn't get to kill Chapel. Chapel blew his own fucking head off, and he still fucking got a boner for killing, I'm sure, over this shit.
Call him a blasphemer. Spawn's looking at him. Spawn is pissed that he's in a bad mood. Then the curse removes his cloak to see that now he has his helmet, and they begin to battle. He jumps at Spawn. He starts slashing at Spawn, kind of kicking the shit out of Spawn. Spawn a little bit, and then Spawn does what?
I don't remember. What do you do?
A backbreaker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because he only hits him like once, and he like snaps his back, punches him, beats him. Just as he's about to finish him off, again, the group that are anti-Spawn of the homeless defend him and talk about, you know, you'll have to go through us if you're going to get to him. And Spawn's not going to do that. You would think he wouldn't do that. But I guess that was...
What a twist.
Yeah, what a twist. You think like Spawn be like, well, you know, these guys are just, they're trying to do their best to defend. And he fucking changed. The changes go wild and start throwing people. Now, I don't think he killed them.
No, he put a fucking hurt on him though, for damn sure.
Yeah, they definitely learned their lesson. And we end with Spawn just finishing beating the shit out of the curse. And then it's the end, perhaps?
Yeah, they put a question mark on there like it's a 50s horror movie, you know, about aliens and shit. It's like, what the fuck is that shit? It's just stopping? We're just going to stop now? Yeah, no, it fucking kills me because after all these issues of shit happening, it feels like too much happens in too short a span of time in this issue. It's like, whoa, slow down. You gave this guy's entire fucking origin in like one panel, mostly in text surrounding the image of him chopping off his own fucking arm. Give me some more curse backstory, please. I could use a little bit more information on Mr. Kron here and how the fuck he managed to accumulate all his wealth and shit. Tell me more about his deal. Just the simple fact that he's shooting Spawn in the back there out of nowhere is like, there was no fucking setup for that shit. You're looking at Terry and Wanda one minute, the next minute Spawn's getting shot. It's like, who the fuck's shooting this guy? This hasn't been set up. What the fuck's going on? Chapel jump back up again? All of a sudden there's just a lot happening, and I'm here for it, but I need more of that, you know, and less fucking Wanda and Terry and all that kind of other bullshit.
True, yeah. I'm telling you, the heart-to-heart shit is just, no.
I agree with you, too, that one of the things that's nice about the curse is his costume is mostly green, like green and black, and then Spawn is, of course, red, white, and black, and the red and the green contrast each other very well, so that when they're fighting each other, they're obviously very distinct from one another, but you have a good color combination there of them fighting. You know, we were talking about the Hulk earlier, where green and purple are good combination, where so is red and green. Good clashy colors. So Curse really feels like he's being set up as being somebody major. I know they've made several action figures of this dude, so he's going to stick around.
I own one.
Yeah. Which one do you have?
The green one.
Right, but I mean, they had one from the earlier Spawn stuff, and then they had one where he's a lot more sculpted, more of like a little statue kind of thing.
I think I have the first one. I think I have the third wave.
Okay.
Because he came out early. Remember, I told you, there were some characters I'm like, who the fuck is this?
Yeah, was he in the comics before the toy, or was
like,
he introduced?
I have the freak. I'm like, who the fuck is the freak?
Right. Do you think the curse was around in the comics by the time the toy came out, or do you think the toy introduced him?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I'd have to go look on the back of the box to see when it was produced. I think Todd was trying to do a little bit of everything. Do your Todd real quick.
No, I don't have anything to say.
I'm just trying to do a little bit of everything. cut that out. That was horrible. I think he was trying to do a little bit of everything, so he was doing toys. I mean, he was doing the merch thing. I mean, they learned from Marvel to really push merch, because Marvel, again, that little documentary I watched was talking about how the thing that really, really chapped McFarlane was that they were selling t-shirts with his Spider-Man on it. Fucking X-Men with Jim Lee's art on. And they didn't get a cut of none of that. And I think they even did a Sotheby's art auction, and their artwork went for like $30,000 and $60,000, and they didn't get a cut of that. And that
now,
was just
how did that happen?
Apparently that's what sealed the deal for Jim Lee. Mm-hmm. When he saw like, holy shit, they're making all this money off me. Even though Jim Lee did leave a door open to come back to Marvel, Todd was like, fuck you, I'm burning bridges.
Right.
And from my understanding from that little documentary, that was the seal the deal moment where he's like, look at all this merch they're selling off of my artwork. So I'm pretty sure when Todd got Spawn, even in 25, he was throwing that shit on everything and anything he could. I remember seeing fucking Pogs with Spawn on it. So yeah. Hell, I own those Pogs.
I'm sorry, those were Spogs. I remember he actually branded it as Spogs.
I think for a while there, I was collecting like just Spawn stuff, but just the really weird shit, because I thought it was so cool. It was just different. Mm. Todd, probably the toy, I wouldn't be shocked if the toy came out before the comic, because he was probably just trying to put out there and see what was popular. Like, hey, this toy sold really well. I got to create something with this. You know, I got to put him on paper. I got to give him a backstory. Because there's a lot of toys that I have that the Freak, I don't think the Freak ever appeared. I'm not sure. I mean, we'll find out later on the line.
Well, I mean, he's in the Image Zero, but he also gets some stories as well.
Does he? Okay. So maybe these were all ideas he already had. And may the bridge stop burn, like the way to a brand new day. Mr. Bad Brain, I'm your fire starter. Shifty gang bang, tank tops and Prada. I'ma get a treasure, heavenly father. Break a 10-4, can you copy me? I'm a villain, killing them, homeboy, please. You can't see the force when you're stuck in the trees. You can't be the boss when you're down on your knees. And you won't get far if you're fucking with me. This
episode, we'll be talking about Keith Giffen's Trencher. So Natcher will begin in 1945 with Bell Features Wow Comics, number 26. Are you ready to go on this journey with me, Mr. Fix-It?
Fuck, dude, this hurts so bad.
To begin with, the War Exchange Conservation Act passed Parliament on December 6, 1940, preventing the importation of inessential items into Canada for the duration of World War II. This occurred just as the U.S. comic book industry was reaching its peak, depriving Canucks of our golden age. Not wanting to leave loonies on the table, four domestic publishing houses sprang up to fill the void left by Superman and Batman with Brock Windsor and Nelvana of the Northern Lights. They were Vancouver's Maple Leaf Publishing and three from Toronto: Anglo-American Publishing, Hillsboro Studios, and Commercial Signs of Canada, the latter becoming Bell Features. There wasn't a big enough market for full color, so most of these books are now referred to as Canadian Whites because they had black and white interior. One minor feature toward the end of Wow's life was Doc Stern by Fred Kelly, about a blonde-haired adventurer who dealt with weird menaces like cavemen and the suicide machine of the Brain Men. Oddly, Doc Stern did serialized stories before they were popular in comics, and probably to his detriment because those stories often crossed over into a whole other title, Commando Comic. For his last two stories before bowing out in 1947, Doc Stern took on a new costume identity of Mr. Monster. However, once color comics from the States came flooding back in, the Canadian Whites folded. End prelude. Now we can talk about Keith Giffen, who grew up on Silver Age DC and Marvel comics, especially those drawn by Jack Kirby.
He's number one to me my entire life. He's the guy who I just love all his stuff. The power that he brought to the page. If you look at a Jack Kirby page, especially in his prime, you look at his buildings. There are no buildings like that in the world. They're totally abstract, but they work. He doesn't do anatomy in his figures. If a character is reaching for something, every line in the arm pointed towards the object. I think he had the perfect approach for comic books. We're not supposed to be realistic. I was never a fan of the Neil Adams or any of these guys who came in and tried this ultra-realistic approach. We're comic books, for God's sake. We have people who fly, so realism goes right out the window. It's ridiculous to have somebody who can make New York look like New York if a big monster is going to come and breathe fire on it. I decided I was going to do comics when I was 8 years old. I still remember the first comic book I ever got. My mother used to sew clothes for people in the neighborhood, fix up dresses. This one woman worked for the factory where all of the comic books were returned to be pulped. So I'd get all these comic books with the top half of the front cover cut off. I never knew what they were called, but the very first one I got was an old issue of World's Finest, and it was by Al Plastino, and I was hooked from then. And then the usual thing, the usual fanboy journey. I went through DC, Dell, Gold Key, wound up at Marvel, and pretty much stayed at Marvel until DC caught up again. When I graduated high school, I did 1 year at the School of Visual Arts in New York, and it was a disaster. 1971. New York was a really strange place, especially down the Village, and the School of Visual Arts, which I thought was going to go and give me lessons on art and layout and how to handle pen and ink and color. And instead, and I'm not making this up, we had a class called Environmental Awareness. Now, I thought environmental awareness meant, you know, drawing cities and perspective and stuff like that. But our classes were, took us all out into the corridor, locked the door so we couldn't get back into the classroom, blindfolded us and told us the first one to stop moving fails for the year. That's why I didn't go back for the second year. I couldn't see going back there. I didn't learn a damn thing. Not about comic books, not about art, nothing. Not about colors or painting, anything. I was working at Johnson Tobacco and Sears, selling cigarettes. That's why I started smoking. I went to Huffman LaRoche. I was an unlicensed hazardous material handler, and just taking out library books on anatomy and perspective, teaching myself how to do this.
Interlude. A 20-year-old fan who shall remain nameless for now pulled a coverless copy of one of those two Canadian Mr. Monster appearances out of a back issue bin and paid 50 cents American for it.
Mr. Monster was actually inspired by a comic book I had seen that had been created in 1947 by a man named Fred Kelly. He was a Canadian cartoonist. He had drawn a single 8-page story, which I stumbled onto in a coverless comic at a convention in 1971, I think it was. This was the New York Comic Convention. I went with my friend Harvey Sobel, who went as Green Arrow. We were both going together to the convention as Green Lantern, Green Arrow, because they were in the comic book that Neil Adams was doing at that time. I borrowed some tights from a girlfriend. I had a green mask, just did a little work. It was the only time I've ever done anything like that, but we actually got separated, so we were both separate, and then they introduced us, and they actually made us shake hands on the stage together, so we actually did wind up getting together.
To be continued. Back to Giffen, who spoke to Wizard Magazine for 1996's issue number 63. I was working for Hoffman LaRouche as a hazardous material handler, big pharmaceutical company, dealing with the transport of biohazardous and radioactive waste and stuff like that. I had a week vacation, and I had been drawing, and I figured, the hell with it, let's go make the rounds.
Figured I had a decent enough portfolio. I wouldn't say it was the best portfolio. I called a couple of the companies, and the most enthusiastic company was Atlas. Called them, and they said, bring it over. We'll love to see it. By the way, we're going out of business in 2 weeks. So I went, and I dropped it off at Marvel. I dropped it off at the receptionist, and she said to me, me point blank, yeah, okay, come pick it up tomorrow. No optimism, no encouragement, nothing. So the next day I thought, oh, I got to go back into New York. Let me give it one more day, as if that makes a difference. I'm going to give it one more day and maybe everything will happen. And I went back the next day and I walked in fully expecting to be handed my portfolio by the receptionist, and she jumped out of her seat and screamed to me, where the hell have you been? During the time my portfolio was there, Ed Hannigan had left the Sword and the Star feature, which was a backup in one of the Marvel black and white magazines. And Bill Mantlow, who was the writer, I don't know how, but he saw my samples and liked them enough, and they wanted to hire me. And being the solid, upstanding professional that I was, I had left my portfolio there with no contact number. My name wasn't on it. I just left the artwork. I didn't leave anything about who I was. She yanked me in, and I was dragged into John Romita's office, given the plot, started working for comics the next day. I did Sword and the Star,
The Deadly Hands of Kung Fu,
Wood God,
and Marvel Preview in 1975.
Odds and ends jobs.
His first regular gig was at DC, providing layouts for Justice Society of America stories.
I'm not sure how it happened, but I wound up going up to DC, and I started picking up work there. I worked on All-Star Comics, which was astonishing to me because I was doing breakdowns and I was being finished by Wally Wood, who's a fucking legend.
He also did various fill-ins, especially on books Jack Kirby had departed, like Kamandi, The Last Boy on Earth.
DC wanted me to stay there, so I didn't do any more work for Marvel. I went to DC and just started screwing up.
He became the regular artist on The Defenders in late 1976, lasting from issues 42 through 54, before jumping back to DC for another Kirby revival, Challenges of the Unknown. Giffen lasted from number 83 to number 87 before the book was claimed by the DC implosion and historically large mass cancellation of titles.
I was on The Defenders for a while, and it was weird because there was a faction at Marvel that wanted me there, Bill Mantlow and some of the creative people, John Romita, and there was the faction at Marvel that definitely didn't want me there, which was Jim Shooter, who happened to be in charge of Marvel at that point, and some of the editors. I was bad. It was bad. I should not have been working professionally in comics. So I bounced around a few odds and ends little projects that Bill Mantlow managed to scrounge up for me. And then
over this period, Giffen made a lot of dumb mistakes, like trying to simultaneously draw two team books and blew it.
Work ethic, arrogance, everything I could possibly have done wrong, I only did well, but I topped it. I would have fired me. I just started screwing up. I wasn't making deadlines. I wasn't getting stuff in. I blew myself out of the business. 2 years, if that. Marvel wouldn't touch me. DC wouldn't touch me. I think it was Paul Levitz, if I remember correctly, who leaned across the desk and screamed in my face, "You'll never work in this business again. Get out." I left the business, figured, well, my dream of comics is over. I'm not going to be able to do it.
He burned all his bridges at the big two and he didn't work after 1978.
Wow.
And aside, 1978 was also the year J.M.O. Barr joined the Marines. And in 1981, he began work on The Crow. How are you liking these random tangents so far?
Feels like I'm reading the comic already.
Also in 1981, again from the Giffen piece in Wizard Magazine number 63, I went off to New Jersey and had all these lousy jobs. I sold vacuum cleaners door to door. I was a repo man.
Wound up working for Dictograph, the alarm company. And my job was basically to try to collect money from the Onassis estate. Did not have anything to do with comics. Did not talk to anybody. Did not communicate with the companies. Started dating Anna, become my wife. After about 2 or 3 months of dating, and she'd always see me doodling all the time. So she knew I could draw. And one day she actually came out and asked me about it. Have you ever thought of doing something with the drawing? So I said, yeah, well, I did. And I told her the whole story. I showed her some of the old comic books and stuff like that. And she was, well, you should get back into it. And I go, forget it. It's dead. It's gone. These people would kill me if I go back in there. And I go over there one evening. I'm greeted with, you have an appointment with Joe Orlando tomorrow. She took it on herself to call DC and set up a meeting between me and Joe Orlando, who actually, I'm surprised, allowed me in the door.
Giffen put together a new portfolio featuring a character he created called Lunatic with a K. Orlando liked what he saw, but not who was showing it to him.
Literally, I went in the next day, pulls me into his office and goes, we liked what you did. Don't like how you did it. We'll give you a second chance. We'll start you off slowly. You screw up once, you're gone. I haven't screwed up since.
He returned to comics with Ghosts number 104, which also featured an early story by Image co-founder Mark Silvestri.
DC used to publish these odd little horror anthologies. Ghosts, House of Mystery, House of Secrets, House of Forbidden Love. Just all these anthology horror books. And back then it was mostly foreign artists. A lot of artists from the Philippines and a lot of artists from South America. And I was shoveled in there to do these short stories. Somebody referred me to Mike Barr, who was an editor. I wound up doing Dr. Fate backups in the back of The Flash
with Marty Pasco and some side gigs for Marvel.
And while I was doing that, I was tapped to do a Legion of Superheroes backup. Paul Levitz liked it enough that he figured he'd give me a shot. I have no idea why he did this. Not enough time had passed for him to get over it. He brought me on board and we started doing the regular Legion series. It took off. For a while, they were consistently the second best-selling book at DC.
After the new Teen Titans.
I have no idea why.
Readers responded strongly to Giffen's work with Paul Levitz on the book, particularly an arc that became known as the Great Darkness Saga.
We were just telling the stories that we wanted to tell, and I managed to keep it on the straight and narrow, so I haven't been without work since.
Did you ever read any of his classic Legion stuff?
No.
Yeah, I didn't figure you were the type.
I do have that one issue you gave me where the birth of a character, where the mom's on this weird alien planet.
Wrong Legion. That's, we'll get to that one. So where were we with Keith Giffen? I personally was introduced to him via a two-page promo in DC Sampler from back when he was still drawing pretty Legion stories. But my proper intro was 1986's Son of the Ambush Bug number 2. So in 1982,
Julie Schwartz needed a story. DC Comics Presents, which is Superman teamed up with people. And it was Superman teamed up with some new Doom Patrol. I don't know what it was about, but we needed a villain. I came up with Ambush Bug.
Ambush Bug was a green garb teleporting villain with antennae.
He was a villain?
Initially, yeah.
He was just a guy in a bug suit. Teleportation powers. And that was just simply because when I first introduced him, he was meant to be a straight villain. He was kind of homicidal in the first one. Then Julie called me back and said he wanted me to do Superman and the Legion of Substitute Heroes. If you're not ready for the Legion of Superheroes, you're in the Legion of Substitute Heroes. It was horrible. Characters like Night Girl, who only gets her powers at night, or Stone Boy. He's just like a statue. And I brought Ambush Bug back in that. He was still a villain. A little bit of a jokey feel.
Turning Ambush Bug into a Looney Tune that wreaked havoc in the 30th century. From there,
like
joined
Mixleplix,
by...
Or?
Mixleplix created mischief, but his stories weren't funny. Ambush Bug was actually intended to be ha-ha funny.
Okay.
It wasn't until Julie Schwartz agreed that we could do Ambush Bug backups in Action Comics that we brought Bob Fleming on board, that Ambush Bug became the character everyone knows.
From there, he was joined by a scripter, Robert Loren Fleming. Giffen started doing these goofy backup strips in Action Comics about the Bug's bumbling attempts to turn over New Leaf as a superhero. Ambush Bug's cult popularity prompted a four-issue miniseries in 1984, a sleeper success that led to a Christmas special and a sequel miniseries. Giffen was simultaneously working on a lot of indie comics like Wally Wood's Thunder Agents, The March Hare, and Videojack, although nothing had the traction of Ambush Bug.
It was breaking the fourth wall. It was goofing around on DC. Yeah, sounds a lot like Deadpool, doesn't it? The one thing Ambush Bug did, I don't think Deadpool does, we were constantly biting the hand that feeds us. We used Julie's head as a villain one time, just his head. We'd make fun of DC. We'd make fun of their special events. We'd make fun of their marketing department. They claimed to like it, but, you know, we heard little things about editors going into Dick Giordano's office and complaining about us. Sometimes our Ambush Bug page would be left on Dick's desk so that he can just review it, and editors would sneak in and read it and pass it around to see if they got attacked. We thought we were just having fun. I drew the whole thing first. I never told Bob Fleming a single thing about what was going on. I just handed him the pages and left the room. He called me one time and he goes, I'm sorry, I'm lost on this page. And I go, what's going on? He goes, well, Ambush Bug pops into the desert and he's chased by elephants. And I went, yes. And he goes, could you tell me why that happened? I said, I felt like drawing elephants. I hung up. It was just the two of us riffing off of one another. There were no liner notes. There was no help with the plot. I handed it to Bob. Here it is. Deal with it. If a book's not fun, it's not worth doing. I've never been on a book where I've had to deal with some bloviating moron who believes that he's doing a work of art. We're not art. We are commerce. We're put out there. If we don't sell, we don't get another one. The whole idea of serious graphic novels. Screw you. I'd rather do a funny book. They're called comics.
What was great about the book was that it was one of the ultra-rare superhero comics that was legitimately funny. So, of course, DC editorial hated it. They wanted desperately to remake DC and Marvel's self-serious, micromanaged image, and some loose cannon making fun of the inherent silliness of comic books was not at all welcome. DC kept stripping more and more access away from Ambush Bug in terms of the properties in the greater DC universe, which was then mocked in a meta-commentary within the Son of Ambush Bug miniseries. That just made DC tighten the reins further until they choked the property to death. In 1983, Giffen launched the Omega Men with Roger Slipher, but left after a half dozen issues. Early in the run, Giffen adapted his lunatic character into a new villain for the series. The intergalactic bounty hunter, now named Lobo, would easily outlive the series that spawned him. Did you ever read Omega Men?
Nope.
Cut to 1983.
13 years after his New York Comic Convention purchase, Michael T. Gilbert was also now a comics professional, best known for drawing with P. Craig Russell and adaptation of Michael Moorcock's Elric. In between adaptations, Gilbert got an offer to contribute a serial feature.
I was offered a chance to create a new superhero for Pacific Comics. They had a thing called Vanguard Illustrated, and they would have short stories by new people and some established creators. They said, come up with something. And I decided, hey, wouldn't it be great to revive this forgotten character, Mr. Monster,
which by that point had fallen into the public domain.
Reinvent him, recreate his costume, and give him an origin, and then go on from there.
Enough tweaks to secure copyright on his version.
It started from that little spark to my mind, let's get the most obscure superhero in the world, this forgotten 8-page story, and see what we can do with it. Who knew that I'd be doing it 30 years later?
Gilbert didn't want to do full art on the feature, so he provided layouts, finishes, and or colors over Journey's William Esner Lopes with letters by Ken Brusenac. The first chapter debuted in July 1984's Vanguard number 7, and then Pacific Comics probably went into bankruptcy. Since this is an Image Comics podcast, let's take a moment to talk about swiping. So Rob Liefeld is the poster boy for the practice, which was so rampant in its heyday that Comic Buyer's Guide would routinely run side-by-side comparisons of the new New Mutants spread where he copied from Frank Miller's Ronin, the Cable cover that's obviously a Mike Zeck roadblock from G.I. Joe, the opening splash from the first issue of X-Force that was lifted from George Perez's New Teen Titans. The truth is, swiping is as old as the industry itself. The media of comics is basically a cheap jack ripoff of comic strip reprint. Jules Feiffer wrote in the 60s about how everyone in the Golden Age, including himself, was constantly swiping from Alex Raymond, Hal Foster, Milton Caniff, and so on. Wally Wood was an admitted and notorious self-swiper because he figured if he did it right once, it would work again and again. But in the early days of fanzines going pro, especially the Comics Journal, artists would get so thoroughly dragged for swiping that it actually hurt their career. Rich Buckler, for instance, was called out for stealing Jack Kirby poses and drawing them in a Neil Adams style so often that he pretty much stopped getting high-profile assignments afterward. Keith Giffen is another example. He has always obviously had an overwhelming Kirby influence, and in his glory days on Legion, he was enough of a Perez clone that it's no wonder only Perez himself was outselling him at DC. However, toward the end of his run, Giffen's art kept getting looser and more impressionistic. Around 1984, his style got very weird and dark and abstract. As it happened, he'd been studying the work of the Argentine illustrator Jose Munoz, who had never been particularly well known in the States. Giffen has said that he never had Munoz's work in front of him when he drew, but if so, he still replicated Munoz's panels so closely that the Journal ran a whole article about it called The Trouble with Keith Giffen that basically called him a thief.
Oh, wow.
The funny thing, though, was that Munoz's style was antithetical to mainstream tastes of the time, and Giffen's changing art style was so thoroughly rejected by fans that his career never recovered. Giffen himself called it career suicide. Hey, when I did that stuff, man, my star sank real fast. Nobody liked it except for a handful of people. Before long, he was off Legion and doing bottom-of-the-barrel books like the last few issues of Hex. Remember Hex?
Kind of, yeah.
Where he's the Mad Max-style post-apocalyptic warrior, the Western character. In an era when old-timers from the Golden and Silver Ages were actively pressured to retire and quit drawing entirely, Giffen became the guy who took over their shit detail fill-ins on whatever random book needed a warm body that month.
Sounds a bit of like a journeyman.
He was getting what he could get. Having said that, I fucking love Giffen's mid-80s Munoz period. The earlier slick stuff was nice, but something about the way Giffen told stories afterward sucks me right in. I adore the 9-panel grid, which helps, but I'm just fascinated by how quirky and unique and inviting that stuff is. To my mind, Giffen is the perfect 80s artist. No one captures the grimy, sweaty, slovenly, malformed creeps stalking Grindhouse New York gutters like Keith Giffen. As a kid, I'd look at a fill-in issue on a trashy New Universe book like Justice, wonder what the fuck the editor was thinking hiring Giffen for that shit, and then hand the lady at the 7-Eleven my 3 bits so I could take it home and marinate in it. Also, in all honesty, I could give a fuck about Jose Munoz. Just not a fan. He does that Dave McKean thing where his shit's all sketchy and the lines have no weight and there's just blobs of black ink. Part of what draws me to Giffen is the unholy marriage of art school pretensions and Scorsese grit with rich, mannered blacks of a Russ Manning or the accessible cartooning of a Charles Schulz. Keith Giffen is the artistic equivalent of Florence Henderson's cameo in Shakes the Clown that gave us Carol Brady as a promiscuous alcoholic. It's inherently subversive, and regardless of the debt it owes to other talents, it is a singular symbiosis. I sincerely think Keith Giffen is one of the greatest and most important comic artists of all time. Any thoughts on Keith Giffen? Do you even know who the fuck Keith Giffen is?
He wrote that goofy version of the Justice League, right?
Yep. We'll talk about that in just a bit.
Yeah. He didn't Dominion.
That was him, yes.
I remember reading the first two issues and then it never finished.
They only did the first two issues. The first one's in color, the second one's in black and white.
It's really interesting. That's about it.
Yeah. Do you remember what Dominion was about?
I want to say it was boys before boys. Like, it was one of those like hyper-violent comics. Wasn't it like Superman and...
Yeah, it's basically, if you ever read his crossover Invasion for DC, it introduced this concept of a metagene. And the idea was that the reason why some people get superpowers and some people just die when weird, stressful stuff, like getting bit by radioactive spider happens, it's because they have an inherent gene within them that gives them powers at times of stress. And so he twisted that concept to what if superpowers was a virus, like zombies or something. And so the island of Australia gets infected with this superhero virus. And so people get superhuman powers and they go nuts and they start blowing shit up and killing each other and all this other kind of crazy stuff. So Dominion was supposed to be about what happens when you're a regular person in the midst of a world where these reckless super beings are running around.
Okay.
It was not a successful book. It came out a really rough time for Image and the industry as a whole. And so again, the first issue was in color. The second issue was in black and white. There was no third issue. Ross Ritchie was the one who was writing the book with Keith Giffen.
Okay.
Eventually, Ross Ritchie formed Boom Studios and they did a new version of Dominion over there that told a story to completion. But neither Ritchie nor Giffen were actually involved with that version of it. Uh-huh. Okay, so moving on. Back to Michael T. Gilbert. After Pacific went belly up, he was broke and out of work after a costly move to California. Luckily, the Elric adaptations were picked up by First Comics, and as a stopgap to pay the bills, Gilbert's agent, Mike Friedrich, talked Eclipse Comics into repackaging the 3 Mr. Monster installments for Pacific into a one-shot. Even before the book was rolled out, graffiti designs so liked the Mr. Monster iconography that they had already had a t-shirt made available, and the special sold well enough to warrant continuation. Did you ever read Mr. Monster?
I believe I did.
Can you tell me anything about the premise?
No.
Can you tell me what he looks like?
Superhero fighting giant beast with giant breast, if I remember correctly.
Okay. But what did Mr. Monster himself look like?
Costume costume was red goggles. It had like a helmet with a mohawk on it, didn't
Finn.
It? Finn. Like a fin, yeah, kind of a Savage Dragon looking thing.
Ran around with twin colts.
Yeah. I just remember seeing an image with him, and there's like these women with huge breasts, and then they had like pterodactyl heads.
Okay. So no other recollection?
I couldn't tell you I've read it. I've seen books of him, but I've never read him.
Well, he's the world's greatest monster fighter. I approach him in a sort of semi tongue-in-cheek. It's a combination of the old EC comics, Tales from the Crypt, and Mad Magazine, and some of my favorite superhero comics, you know, by Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby. I try to make sort of an amalgam. One of the things I object to with some of the modern comics is that they take themselves so seriously, and they have these multi-textured plots. It seems, 50 different comics are interrelated, and it seems more like a video game than it does a comic book. And what I admired from the comics from the 1940s and 50s and early 60s was there was a simple, direct approach to the comics that would just get you into the comic. And sometimes it would just be an 8-page story. They didn't have to have a 200-page graphic novel to tell a story. They could do it in 4 pages if they had to. And that's the kind of stuff that I've been trying to do with Mr. Monster for all these years. Studying Harvey Kurtzman early on was a big influence on that. And I got to see a sense of silliness and building up to a punchline and such. And it served me well. I mean, in addition to Mr. Monster, I've also written a good deal of Disney material for Donald Duck stories and such. And I'm currently working on a SpongeBob story for the comic books and such. And it's fun to be able to go back and forth between the funny stuff and the serious stuff.
The Mr. Monster stories were notably dense. And beyond the obvious influence of Walt Eisner on his work, Gilbert also decided to employ the Golden Age Eisner production model to get the work out. Gilbert continued to set up and finish the stories, but he didn't have other artists do the full pencils.
With Mr. Monster, it was always exciting for me to be able to work with some artists that I've really admired and see what we can work on together. But the overall vision of Mr. Monster, just like the overall vision of the spirit from Will Eisner, was Will Eisner's vision. He's the one who said how it was going to look and the overall feel. And no matter who I worked with, I was always in charge of what Mr. Monster would look like.
And he employed guest writers to write the stories as well, including Alan Moore. I think he wrote like the second or third issue.
Alan Moore was terrific. We worked through the phone, but he was a very friendly guy and we hit it off really nicely. It was during the very early days of Mr. Monsters, like the first, within the first 2-3 issues. I think I contacted him about the time we were about to come out with issue 1. Asked him if he'd be interested in doing something. He would, and he gave me this incredibly dense script, which was just wonderful and very exciting to work from. I think it was like, it was supposed to be for a 12-page story? 12 or 16, I forget. But anyway, it was like 32, 36 pages of single space type stuff. And he'd be talking about how, I'm going to go to the typewriter now. He's clicking around. He's just talking about what he's doing sort of to warm up. And then he gets into the story and he's just making descriptions from each panel. And this might be what's in the background possibly. And beyond that, you can imagine there might be something else there. It was a lot of fun.
So Bill Loeb's produced art for most of the stories, but there were also ones done by Don Simpson, Mark Pacella, and even one Keith Giffen. There was also a crossover with Bat and Lash's Supernatural Lawyers Wolf and Bird, which both creators contributed to. While the book was a nominee for Best New Series at the 1986 Jack Kirby Awards, it was beset with lengthy production delays, including 7 months between the initial special and the ill-advised second issue rather than a new number one. Despite all the assistance, most of the issues featured public domain reprints of Golden and Silver Age horror anthology material to round them out. In fact, there was a second stopgap series called Mr. Monster's Super Duper Special, which is almost entirely reprints of Fiction House's The Secret Files of Dr. Drew Strip by Marilyn Mercer and Jerry Grandinetti, with brief new Mr. Monster interstitials that lasted 7 installments. Eclipse ultimately put out 10 issues in 30 months, as well as a 3D special and an Airboy one-shot crossover.
The fun thing with me and Mr. Monster is I'm my own editor and my own writer, and I can make the stories as silly or as serious as I feel it needs it for that particular story, and that's a lot of freedom.
One of DC's many attempts to court Marvel fans was a radical reinvention of the Justice League of America as a multicultural X-Men clone that was pilloried by the fans. In 1987, the aging title was getting canceled and rebooted. Nobody wanted to work on it because everybody hated the new characters and the old ones didn't sell anymore. Anyway, with a full slate of high-profile reboots, other icons, John Byrne's Superman, Frank Miller's Batman, and George Perez's Wonder Woman, none of the characters you'd really want on the League were available to them. Giffen would walk by editor Andy Helfer's door and hiss, Justice League.
I'd been working on again, off again for Andy Helfer, penciling backups from the Atari Force book and just doing little bits here and there. I used to hang out in his office while waiting for the other editors to come free. I was always after him. I started off jokingly, hey, give me the Justice League. This is when Justice League was in Detroit. It was horrifying. It was just on its way out. And I kept going and going. And then one day I said it and Andy said, okay, what do you got? And I had nothing. John Byrne had done a crossover. There were certain DC characters that were going to be in a new Justice League. Launch a new Justice League book. Andy asked me if I wanted it. I said, Justice League, great. Yes, I'll take it. Then he hands me the characters. And I was expecting Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Arrow. Hey, the big guys. I got Blue Beetle, Captain Marvel, Dr. Fate. The only character that was in there from the old Justice League was like Batman. And they never let up the pressure at DC to take Batman out of the book. They did not like what we were doing. Denny O'Neill kept Batman in there as sort of, he enjoyed the frustration that DC was feeling because I was transitioned into writing.
He wasn't confident enough in his writing abilities, and DC sure as hell weren't going to let him draw the damn thing. The writer of the last few issues of the previous Justice League volume was kept over to script Giffen's plots.
And don't forget, Mark DeMatteis was brought on board to do the dialogue. Mark was known as this esoteric kind of mystical writer. He had Moonshadow and all of these philosophical books, and he was not known as a superhero writer. We were opposite ends of the spectrum. And then Kevin McGuire was an artist and Romita's Raiders at Marvel. Romita's Raiders was like a place where I guess they kept people who had to draw something. It was like how you trained a new artist. He got the job on a drawing. Andy Helfer showed me. I got on this guy. He's great. I go, really? What is it? He hands me a drawing of Batman. Just one drawing. One picture of Batman, but it's Clint Eastwood. That's how Kevin got the job.
To draw over Giffen's layouts.
We really didn't understand what we had going until an issue called Moving Day, when we just put the humor forward. The sales hadn't come in yet. We had no idea how this book sold. But we were looking at what we did, and I thought, oh God, I've laid an egg. And Mark DeMatteis agreed. He was looking for work. Kevin was pulling his portfolio together. We thought we had failed on every level. We thought, oh my God, we've just totally misfired. And the sales came in. It was incredible. The book just took off from there. None of us expected it to work, especially when we put the humor in. I guess we didn't think enough of the fans, and they showed us. Our league is always referred to as the Wahaha Justice League. I'm grateful for that. People usually cited it as a run that they enjoyed. When we get together with our friends, it's not all doom and gloom. We're joking around. We're goofing. We're usually embarrassing one guy. We're getting up to stunts. We're pulling stuff on one another. I thought, why wouldn't these guys do it? The fans loved it. DC hated it. DC was always after us. It would be so much better if you took the humor out.
The Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatteis, and Kevin McGuire creative team then became one of the most beloved of all time, and the trio still worked together on projects over 30 years later. Despite being a quite funny send-up of superheroes, Justice League International replaced New Teen Titans as DC's most consistent high seller, and was much more successful at spinning off a slew of other titles. As a plotter, Giffen soon had more work than he knew what to do with. So did you ever read any of the funny Justice League stuff?
No.
Still to this day?
Yep.
I know I've loaned you some, and you still haven't bothered to read it, huh?
Like, what do you mean, funny Justice League stuff?
The Justice League International, Blue Beetle, Booster Gold.
I own some of that. I want to read it because the McGuire artwork is just phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
I remember you praised the shit out of it, and I always loved the fact that Martian Manhunter had a drug-addicted dependency on Oreos. I just thought that was fucking hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Am I correct?
Yeah, that's all about right.
I think I read, like, an odd issue here or there, like, where
you read the Martian Manhunter issue that was inspired by Justice League International and drawn by Doug Monkey, and I think you actually own some pages of artwork of that.
I remember reading one with fire and ice. Don't they go to hell or something? And
oh, that was one of the JLA classified stories, I think.
Yeah, and Gork, whatever, the Green Lantern. Yeah. I thought it was actually pretty funny. I was just like, that's kind of cool.
Giffen's one of the only guys who can work with people and make comics that you actually find funny instead of being sad and pathetic and humor.
Didn't they basically, for the Justice League animated cartoon, kind of steal one of his ideas for
Booster Gold, the greatest hero that ever was?
Yeah.
They developed Booster Gold. It's funny because everybody, like Dan Jurgens, created Booster Gold, and he certainly did. But the character that most people like, Rob Liefeld created Deadpool, but the version of Deadpool that everybody really loves was mostly created by Joe Kelly and Ed McGuinness. Dan Jurgens created Booster Gold, but the version of the character everybody loves was given DeMatteis and...
Yeah, because I mean, that's one of my favorites where they put Booster Gold as crowd control.
Yeah.
And he has his little adventure, and that's kind of one of my favorites because it's so odd.
A lot of people love that episode, yeah.
Yeah, it's just so unusual. So I actually like Booster Gold, and I've actually read Booster Gold stuff just because of that. And
that concept of the character didn't come from the actual creator of the character.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess you could say I've read more Giffen than I thought.
Michael T. Gilbert's prospects were now less certain. While still appearing in Eclipse Comics promotions and crossovers, Mr. Monster as a property had already moved to Dark Horse Comics in 1988 for the more serious, serialized Origins miniseries, this time in black and white with extensive tones. It was weird because it was almost a betrayal of the appeal of the series because this whole thing was like no continuity, big bombastic fun stories, and he decided to do this really dark, grim and gritty, depressive, Alan Moore-esque Mr. Monster story that kind of killed the property.
Okay.
Despite again leaning on supplemental reprint material, the severe production delays continued, and the 8-issue Dark Horse run wasn't completed until 1991. Think about that. Began in 88, doesn't end until 91, only produced 8 fucking issues. issues. Around that same time, Given and Demetis were winding down their 5-year JLI run.
I left when I decided I wanted to leave. We weren't forced off the book. When I left the Justice League, there were still hundreds of Justice League stories that could be told, but there were no more I wanted to tell.
Plus, Giffen had a critical darling, Bold New Direction, Legion of Superheroes, scripted by Tom and Mary Beerbohm, a 20th century prequel series that spelled L-E-G-I-O Legion as an acronym with Alan Grant, and most importantly, a breakout spinoff miniseries starring the aforementioned Lobo.
He appeared first in Omega Men. Lobo didn't really take off until Simon Bisley came along. I did him in a couple of issues here and there, but he didn't really take off until Alan Grant and I got together and Simon Bisley came along and defined the character.
He was pretty much a minor character, supporting sort of chap, had shortish hair and didn't really amount to much, and then you took him over as a limited series.
I did, yeah.
And really put yourself into him.
Yeah.
He looked like you, he wore your leather jacket.
He didn't look like me so much.
Yeah, he looked a lot like you. And you had long hair and...
Well, I had the long hair, the whole fucking bucket thing going on, I suppose, yeah.
Now that the polarizing editor-in-chief, Jim Shooter, had been ousted at Marvel, the big talent that had once been driven to DC had returned home, plus Marvel was developing a whole new stable of superstar artists. DC was increasingly losing market share and relevancy. The heat generated by swaggering anti-hero Lobo, was drawn by emerging UK illustrator Simon Bisley, was exactly what they were looking for.
I did Lobo as an indictment. I did not expect it to be popular. DC put Simon Bisley on it because they could find no other, they didn't know what else to do with him, so they just threw him on the book. They pretty much ignored us because we were just doing this book. We got 4 issues. I think it was just, yeah, Keith's done good for us. Let's just give him this fucking, you know, let him do his thing. And I just went out to make a reprehensible character. I think the first issue, he is repossessing his fourth grade school teacher. And that was because everyone hates their fourth grade school teacher. I don't know anyone who likes their fourth grade school teacher. Fourth grade school teachers are horrible people. We threw it together and I thought that was it. And it was sort of my indictment of heroes who kill. I mean, Wolverine was killing, all these heroes were killing, and I was kind of pissed off about it. So I figured, okay, fine, let me just have my say. That was it. It's done. And it took off. Not only did everyone reading it miss the joke, but the joke became the selling point.
It was now where his biggest checks were coming from.
Hello, my name is Simon Bisley.
My father's in the REF, so I went to, I maybe 30 different schools in my lifetime. Went from one school to another to another. Sometimes I was in a school for a year, maybe 2 years, 3 years max. So I was going through the whole process of going from one country to another country, to one state to another state, to one county to another county. So I never settled in. So I was only son as well of sisters, and 4 sisters by then. I was pretty much a kind of a loner. I never really kind of like got any kind of grounding. I was always going through the whole kind of process of hierarchy. Where does he stand in this group? I went from one fucking pile of shit with the alpha male of the school, the tough guy, and his gang. So I got through that shit, whether I won or lost, then I went to another one. So they established myself to a degree, then I went to another school. So I was being berated or tested throughout my life. So I became more and more insular, self-protective, self-contained. It was really difficult as shit, so I was never one of the boys, a lad. I drew a great deal in the early days when I was in a sixth form school in Scotland. It was based in Scotland, drawing animals, and I discovered Frazer when I was older. I think I was about 16 when I got into the fantasy artwork, so I started messing around with that. But I was always drawing, even before I could remember. So that was always with me. It wasn't so much as I'd go into it and drawing. I think it was only when I was older, after art college, after Banbury, I was about 18 years old and left, but I had aspirations to become a comic book artist. But you know, the thing was interesting, it wasn't so much as me learning how to paint and draw as much as I was starting to smoke cigarettes and was drinking and discovering women. So I was growing, my balls were dropping an extra few inches lower. I was becoming more of a man physically through natural kind of like progression of biology or whatever. So I was more interested in just, you know, what the hell's going on as far as women went. I was totally rebellious, totally against the world, totally against everybody. I don't know if I learned anything at all. What do I want to get from it? From college, art college? Well, nothing. Nothing. Resentment. Jealousy. Because I was talented. And guess what? I ain't that talented at most things, but I'm really good at what I do as far as art goes. And that's not arrogance, that's just a fact. I'm just was good at what I did. I don't think there was like, not something, I don't know if it's jealousy or just like, who's this guy I think he fucking is, you know, coming in here and just like being able to do this in an instant, finding things so easy. So I was kind of, they shut me off. I mean, it's all that was, when I left school, I put in art college. I was rejected by Brian Art College and Coventry. And I think I turned up with my artwork rolled up in a plastic bag. I had no idea about presentation or wise or means or shape or form. It was what I was meant to be saying. I just really didn't have a fucking clue. I mean, I was really quite deluded. I mean, I didn't know. I had no idea what I was doing there. What the purpose? Maybe I was stupid. All I said in my interviews was, look, why do you want to go to art college? Because if I get to art college, get through the course, I'll get a job. That's why I saw things. Not, I mean, I was pretty basic kind of fellow. I mean, even like now, I'm pretty like bacon and eggs, you know. Dana was a simplistic fellow and pretty stupid most of the time. Not that well educated. Yeah. So I didn't have the intellect, or I guess, to talk my way through to the course. I had a talent, but it was just too much of a grunt. I think at Barrowby they probably had a lot of bad things to say about me. He's arrogant, he's rude, he just doesn't give a shit and everything else. But what I did not give a shit is except that I didn't know that I had to give a shit. That when I left school, just doing manual labour, which makes sense, you know. Spent my life in building sites, and I became a welder. I was like a human forklift. Before they had a forklift, working at a paving company, stacking paving stones, paving slabs, 2x2 inch fucking things, stacking them on lorries all day. I must have shifted, must have been 6 tons of concrete a day. I used to read the old early Easy Rider magazines. That influence came from anywhere in particular, just always about motorbikes. I was into music at the time, like Motorhead, you know, that was from Scotland in 1976. Punk era, which died a quick death in my mind as soon as Motorhead came out with. But I was into motorbikes. Love motorbikes, yeah. I was buying GT250 Suzuki's. I used to strip them down and rebuild them, making them faster. Motorbikes, heavy metal, it's pretty cliche, but it was not like a thing. I wasn't trying to make a thing out of it, just what I was into. It still appealed to me now. Yeah, what it was, I applied to go to Swindon, the degree course. After years of working, I was accepted. That day, I got a phone call from the course leader, or something like that. Yeah, he said, "Why are you not turning up?" I said, "Well, in the meantime, I got a job with 2000 AD because I showed them my portfolio." That was through a friend of mine, mutual friend of the family. So I'm going to do some three-year degree course. Actually, in the meantime, I was also trying to join the RAF, Royal Air Force. So basically, I was with my current wife. I needed to get a job. So it was a choice of two angles. Try to join the Royal Air Force as a PTI instructor, and at the same time, trying to get a degree course.
I got in the industry when I was, I think, in my 20s, in 1988. I took some of my work to a company in London, 2000 AD, the guys who published Joe Dredd, and I got a job there and then, on the spot. They employed me straight away. They said my work looked scratchy, because traditionally, artists then, you would use brush pens, you know? But I would do it with a pen, so one of these. So to them it looked kind of scratchy, to the style I used. So I progressed from there, moved pretty quickly into working with DC Comics, and had them for quite a long time.
Bisley got his start on ABC Warriors in 1987.
First thing I did was a... was that the first thing I did? I thought it was the Kerrang! Cover piece. But you think it was a Mortal Sin piece?
I'm not sure.
Damn, I don't know which one came first. Either way, when I was at college, I did some artwork, and some of it was work that was sent to 2000 AD. I did some robots, some cyborgs, whatever. I'd done that for my art course, as it worked. Well, not my art course, but I did some work to get myself into a degree course. The body of work I did send was sent to 2000 AD that created the interview. Pat Mills saw that, he liked it, got an interview with 2000 AD, accepted it, said, "Yeah, we want you to work in the ABC Warriors." It was like head fuck. It was amazing. Basically, Pat wrote a story, I think, based around the characters I created, the robot cyborgs I created. He naturally gives people respect. For looking at it, he's worked with the most original artists. Yeah, the most different, the most creative people. He never encouraged me to be myself. He just recognised self, and he recognised worth in the artist for his own sake, not for his own.
Pat Mills liked his work and continued using him into 1988 on Slain and Judge Dredd. Do you remember Slain?
Like a Conan ripoff.
By the time Bisley was done with it, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, because you began on ABC Warriors, which is black and white line work, and then progressed to be drawing Slain.
Mm.
And in the space of about a year or 18 months, you were pretty much the hottest property in the UK comic market.
Was I? So Pat was right there in employing me. I tell you what, they're amazing to me, because it was new to me as well. I mean, this might sound like really arrogant, but maybe it is arrogance. I was surprised, because I did it so quickly. What I was producing was surprising to me. But the thing is, I knew it was good. I knew what I was doing was fucking good. I think, this is fucking amazing. This is great. I was young, remember? Spunky. And I think, maybe Pat was surprised at my progression, and everyone was. And we all knew it was good, so it was exciting for everybody. Because I think I was doing, it's fully painted stuff. I mean, you're going from like normal black and white with a bit of colour wash to the fully painted rendered, bizarre kind of style of work. So you get a great deal of quality, a great deal of effort.
Biz took off like a rocket, becoming a hugely influential artist across the pond in short order. This attracted the attention of DC, who brought him on in 1989 to do painted covers for Doom Patrol.
So I was doing Slain, then I did Doom Patrol covers, yeah? I mean, Doom Patrol was a natural progression from Slain, because you're getting more confident, more chunky, more kind of abstract. I'm way more confident with things, you know. I think I've discovered a different style, you know, using colour pencil to filling the colors, and they're way more aggressive, more freeform.
His pen and ink work on the Lobo miniseries debuted in 1990.
I think I remember when I got a phone call from Alan Grant. He said, hey, Simon, I've got a character, I'm doing a work on a character with Keith Gibbon called Lobo. Do you want to work on him? Do you want to do a strip with him? I said, what's he about? So he said, send me some pictures. I said, do you want to redesign him and do what you want to do with him? So I did. To redesign him, liked it, and did the comic book.
Drawing Lobo and drawing Batman is very easy, so it's an easy thing to draw. So it's like very slick. And I enjoy the process, except with Lobo's chain. Why did I fucking draw those chains? Because every panel I've got to draw the fucking chains, you know? I'm really good at drawing chains quickly now. I could draw a chain really quick because I've gotten used to it, you know.
Yeah.
I could do that for a living. I sit just drawing chains. Like a...
I haven't read The Red Is Powers or read any kind of like... I didn't read it. I think it was a good amalgamation, a good kind of a gel. I think Keith Giffen, myself and Alan Grant just fucking gelled. It just happened to have the right kind of formula, the right ingredients to make something really work well. I think Keith Giffen was more Lobo. His attitude was very kind of Lobo. Don't give a shit, fucking hard ass. Fucking don't, you know, whatever day, you know, kind of thing. Whereas I had to kind of, I was drawing Lobo, but at the same time I had the kind of Monty Python-esque Q8 Spike Milligan kind of sense of humour. Alan Grant had that dark humour. Keith Kim was very un-American. Not very un-American, but very, he had very much of a kind of European kind of sense of things, you know? And he's a very angry guy. And he was like Lobo, really. He was the angst. I was the humour. Alan was the darkness, you know what I mean? But what happened was Keith Kiffin would draw the character out in storyboard form and write loose dialogue, and then what I would do for now, I would draw it as I see it, add my own shit to it, the gorillas and everything else, and then Alan Grant would then take the story from my finished product and just rewrite it. It was a jam, in effect. I think Keith was quite dominant in his foresight. He really did know what he wanted for the character, and I had this other take on it. I think it was a bit more typical, a bit more kind of heavy metal, obvious, really. I think what the correct character kind of needed, required, I suppose, and just made it a bit more hardcore. I do go on bullshit and go on about, yeah, man, he's, you know, Lobo's really my creation, I really reinvented him, all this stuff, but no, I was just only part of the package, you know.
He made his hair longer, he gave him the distinctive
look and the attitude and the humour. I mean, I think, but we all added that, it was a team effort, I think it was all a team effort. I love to work those guys again on Lobo, we were just perfect for it. Well, Keith is real dark, fucking, was really quite dark, I thought. He had the dark side, he had the dark mentality on what Lobo was, you know. Alan Grant had the sarcasm and the dry wit.
What can you tell me about Simon Bisley?
Great artwork. Red is Bad Boy.
Yeah, Frank Miller wrote that one.
Yeah, primarily an artist.
I don't think he's written anything. I think he's only ever done
an
art.
Yeah. I can't think of anything. I mean, his art style is very distinctive. You see his artwork, you know it's him. I would put him in the vein of what's his name? Frank Frazetta. Yeah, in that same vein of like very masculine, very macho artwork. Big tits, big asses, dudes with big guns. Yeah, I've always been a fan.
So about Simon Bisley.
Wait. Who did the Lobo special, the Christmas special?
Bisley drew it. Giffen wrote it.
Probably one of the greatest DC comics ever written.
Funny. Love the funny,
fucking,
right?
Yeah. Love the fucking ending where when he finishes reading it, it tells him, because I think the story is they're going to have to kill their kids, right? If they don't entertain them for Christmas or some shit like that.
It's been a while since I've read it.
I have to reread it, but I believe that was the whole notion, is they were going to have to kill their children because the children would destroy them in the morning for not having gifts.
Right.
And if you read up his story, it'll get you through the night. And then right when you get the last page, it says, oh, by the way, if you read the story out loud, it erases or some shit. Like, you can't reread it. And they're like, well, got to kill the kid. I want to say that is, I could be wrong.
That sounds, now that I think about it, I think what it was is,
I haven't read that since the 90s.
Yeah, for those who haven't read the special, Lobo is hired to kill Santa Claus, who is this tyrannical sweatshop owner, and manages to do so. And because Santa's dead, there's no Christmas. And when the parents realize they're going to have to kill their kids on Christmas Day without presents, they're encouraged to kill their children in their beds
reading that and thought, oh my God. And honestly, that made me a fan of Lobo, and I would end up reading the Alan Grant shit.
And Alan Grant did script the special. I have to give him credit for that. Yeah.
Okay, because it was...
Giffen plotted it. And then Alan Grant did an ongoing series that did not have any contributions from Giffen or Bisley.
But who did the dialogue?
Grant did the dialogue.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But the thing is, Giffen would give dialogue suggestions. He was very much like a Jack Kirby, where he would lay out the books, he would offer suggestions, and then the scripter could either adapt that into something with a little more pizzazz or kind of do their own thing, as long as they follow the basic story. So Giffen probably still contributed to that humor, regardless, because Alan Grant, I'm sorry, nothing I've ever read by Alan Grant indicates that he's funny without Keith Giffen.
Yeah. When I was going to say, I've read some some other stuff that he wrote, and I was just like, yeah, no.
The Lobo Paramilitary Christmas Special was actually a joke. Like, it was offered as a submission, as a gag, just to fuck with people, and then DC actually bought it.
Yeah.
And then they had to actually produce the damn book.
And it was fantastic.
Yeah. It is really great. Giffen has done, because he also did the Ambush Bug Stocking Stuffer, and that's another one of the great Christmas specials, funny Christmas specials ever.
How is that not your handle, man?
It was. My very first email address was the alter ego of Ambush Bug.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, the Lobo Paramilitary Christmas. Oh, okay. How that came about. After I was done with those four issues of Lobo, I did up this plot, the Santa Claus thing. I sent it in to, I think, the editor at the time. I might have sent it to Simon Bisley as well. I was not hired by DC to do this. I just did it as a goof. And I get a phone call going, "We're doing it." And I'm going, "Doing what?" The Christmas thing. And I'm thinking, whoa. What Christmas? You know, somebody had passed it around and they decided to do it. I never intended the damn thing to get done. It was meant to be a goof.
Lobo pays my rent. He pays my bills. So yeah. I can't complain.
Later, he did the painted crossover Batman Judge Dredd, Judgment on Gotham, and covers for Dark Horse's The Terminator and Grendel Warchild.
Oh, yeah. I remember Grendel Warchild. Fantastic book.
And aside, I started having reliable access to a flea market comic shop in 1981, followed by an actual neighborhood store in 1992. So this was when I finally started getting distributed catalogs and pre-ordering my comics. It also meant I could pick up the odd industry magazine like Amazing Heroes or Comic Buyer's Guide. When Wizard Magazine started up, I picked up the first four issues or so. The third issue had an interview with Bisley that featured a painfully obnoxious gonzo self-insertion from the writer, overselling Biz as some sort of demonic rock star of comics. As it happens, I'd picked up one issue of a British anthology magazine called Blast that randomly landed on the shelf of the flea market. Wizard had bought the interview from Blast to reprint it for the US market. I, of course, felt like it was a ripoff, even though I may be the only person on Earth that bought both Blast and Wizard Magazine. So, just a weird random thing. I don't know if Wizard ever bought an interview besides that one. That's the only time I know of where they bought an interview from another magazine. And again, this was in the early days. So there's this one quote from the interview that I think sums up Bisley's entire career. "I like drawing big naked people with big lumps of metal in their hands." Then he goes on to talk about how he ignored Pat Mills' script and turned Slane into an airbrushing from off the side of a van because he knew it's what people like him would want to see. For instance, "Women with large breasts. I do like curvy women.
So, I called it.
So why shouldn't I draw them?"
Let me guess. He was really into metal too.
Oh yeah.
He had to be a metalhead.
Metal and speed. He loved speeding around in his vehicle. He had a Vespa.
I thought you meant like drugs. No.
I don't know if there were drugs but he definitely liked, yeah.
He's like, gotta do 20 pages. Let's get rock.
He was talking about getting busted doing 130. So yeah, he liked to speed, physically speed. In that same interview, he slagged a bit on his imitators, but noted, "I don't suppose I'm original either. My stuff is a culmination of Frank Frazetta, Richard Corbin, and Bill Sienkiewicz." Right? Yeah.
Dude, I called this shit.
Absolutely. Meanwhile, Giffen had begun the semi-creator-owned The Heckler at DC with the Beer Bombs, about a Spider-Man type with a bit of Ambush Bug's wackiness. The Beer Bombs lacked the flair for humor of Giffen's other collaborators, and despite it being dear to his heart, Giffen voluntarily ended Heckler after six issues due to abysmal sales. Giffen was also plotting an Eclipso series that had spun out of an event he'd done with Fleming and his flashy Justice League Europe artist Bart Sears. Their initial success was not replicated. Sears bolted early on to work at Valiant and Image and was soon joined by Giffen himself.
I was offered an Image book and I did talk to DC about it. And for a while there, they were even floating the idea of letting me do an Image style book up at DC. It was even talked about, well, you can head. I put together a bunch of books and people would work on it and I get a percentage of every book. But my head was in, wait a minute, I haven't done any work on it. You know, I don't want to be that guy. So I wound up at Image.
In the May 1993 issue of Inside Image, he was asked why he left DC after working there near exclusively for 11 years. You're kidding, right? Just consider what Image stands for. Complete control over all aspects of your creation. The real question isn't why I came over to Image. It's what took me so damn long. Inertia, brand loyalty, I really don't know. God knows Al Gordon and Eric and Todd and Jim Valentino all tried their damnedest to get me to see the light. But I'm here now and planning to stick around for the long haul. He also mentioned his upcoming work on Super Patriot, Bloodstrike, and Images of Shadowhawk. Also plans to tie Trencher in with Wildstar via a really neat little twist that, to my knowledge, never happened. Now, you read Trencher number one. What happens in that issue?
You mean the one with no words?
No, not the one with no words. The first issue of Trencher.
I didn't read First Trencher.
I thought you did.
No, you didn't tell me to. You told me to read that one with no words.
I also told you to read Trencher number one. I'm going to use the solicitation copy to give you a brief synopsis. Trencher is an all-new, ongoing monthly series chronicling the over-the-top travails of one Gideon Trencher, working stiff extraordinaire. Trencher's job is to repossess misplaced or errant reincarnated souls by any means necessary. Unfortunately for him, the advent of superhumans has tended to complicate what was already a pretty sucky job. Trencher, if not already dead, would kill himself. Do you have any idea what happens in Trencher just from flipping through issue number one?
Yeah, they did a Lobo book.
Did you ever read Lobo Infanticide?
Yeah. Well, which is the one where he goes to heaven and he gets kicked out of heaven and goes to hell?
That's Lobo's back.
Okay,
Lobo's back. That was the one that Bisley did like three quarters of it, and the final issue had to be finished by somebody else.
And then Lobo's back came along and I didn't want to do it. That's the book that got me free of Lobo, by the way. I'm doing it, and I think in between I had done some other little Lobo things that didn't come out until later, like Blazing Chain of Love and a couple of one-shots. I hate the character, by the way. I've said it many times. He's a despicable character. He's a villain. He's the villain of the piece, for God's sake. I was talking to Dick Giordano, and I said, I really don't want to do this character. And Dick says, but, you know, it's popular. Just go through it. I said, I'll tell you what. I'll make you a deal. I'll stay on the book, but the first time you censor me, I get to leave. And I'm not stupid. I'm not going to throw naked women or anything weird in there. I'm just going to go along and do my normal stuff. And the first time you stop me, I get to leave. And Dick goes, okay, fine. And we lasted until the fourth issue of Lobo's back with that full page shot when Lobo dies and goes to heaven and he meets Torquemada and the Inquisitors of Doom. That was not the original page. The original page was Combat Christ and the Howling Apostles. Didn't make it. And I got a call from Dick and Dick said, okay, you're free.
Yet they kept
me around to draw Lobo of all things. I can never get free of the character. The character is going to haunt me forever.
Giffen came back for the Infanticide miniseries and that's where he debuted the art style that he used for Trencher. He only used that art style a few times. He used it for a few fill-in pages on the Eclipso event. He used it for that Lobo miniseries, and he mostly otherwise used it on Trencher. So this isn't the art that I was praising from the 80s. This is a very specific art style with him experimenting.
I wanted to try something different. I was starting a book that was totally mine. I had no restrictions, no editor to answer to. I didn't have to answer to the company. I did not pencil. I took a Rapidograph pen. I would put it on the paper. I draw his glasses. I draw the bottom of his soul, and I just connected it. All those Trencher issues, I didn't pencil. I took the pen, went right to the paper.
Just a quick side note. I used to hang out with a crew of taggers, and this art style was very popular among them.
Hergé, who did Tintin, there were comparisons between those two. Mm-hmm. It's a style where you do not have line depth. All the lines have the same thickness to it, mm-hmm. So you don't have a clear separation between figures and their backgrounds.
I didn't spot blacks.
And it's a very squiggly, heavily ornate style.
I knew a couple of guys that would tag, and when they would hit a wall or bomb a wall, they would do that same style, which of course I'm sure they picked up from the book, because that was another thing.
Yeah, well, you don't think it was necessarily Trencher or just comics in general?
Comics in general. Find a style like that was so different and weird and tag walls with that,
because mm-hmm.
It just stood out. I just remember a guy, I think because of him is where I was introduced to Trencher, because I never saw a Trencher comic, and then these guys did a wall somewhere and I remember looking at it, and this guy was a huge comic book collector, so I'm sure swiped given style himself. Mm-hmm. So.
It was just trying something different, and like I said, I would just take the blank piece of paper and start drawing on it in Rapidograph. Sometimes I draw in the upper left hand corner, bottom, and connect the two. There's people who love it and the majority who hate it.
So what happens in the story though? It
looks like he's trying to go capture a character from Martial Law.
He looks a little like suicidal, yeah.
No, dude, it's suicidal, except he has noses. I mean, come on. No, he's in blue instead of green. He goes after him. So in Martial Law's book, the Martial Law's leader, who's this skinny, slimy, scumbaggy commander with a high top fade, Trencher has the same version, but it's a female. So I'm assuming she's going to be bad.
So the basic premise of Trencher is that a bunch of souls were reincarnated inappropriately.
Yeah, wrongfully reincarnated people.
These people died and they were supposed to stay in heaven or hell, but instead they got reincarnated. And so they send an agent to repossess all these misplaced souls. But the complication is that in the years since this began happening, superhumans have come about. And so their Trencher, which is sort of like a reanimated corpse married to cybernetic parts and chassis and stuff, is going to have to go up against these superhumans to collect those souls, to send them back to heaven or hell, because they're not supposed to be alive on Earth. And so the first issue, he gets teleported to Earth. One of the first people he goes after is the Nasal Python, who's the guy who looks a little like Suicida. But the fact is that character is killed. He's repossessed before the end of the issue. So you're making way too big of a deal of a character who only appeared the one time. But the Nasal Python's power was basically he has prehensile nose hairs that he can use to attack people. Later in the issue, you've got a character who's a little old lady, or appears to be. It turns out she's a Nazi / commie villainess from World War II era named Cher Noble. And she's another one who needs her soul repossessed. But the difference is when the Trenchers come, because there's supposed to be more than one Trencher, even though we don't really see any other Trenchers, sort of, kind of. We'll get to that in a minute. The Trenchers are supposed to know what's going on with the repossession of the souls. The people they're going to repossess are not supposed to know what's going on. So the fact that this person knew who he was, what he represented, and fought him to save her own life was a real kink in the way things are supposed to work out. Now, Cher Noble, I believe, is also a cyborg, and so she's able to use her enhancements to blow the shit out of Trencher, which carries us into the second issue, so let me read the solicit copy on that one. More mayhem as everybody's favorite repo man clashes head-on with Cher Noble, the geriatric mutant cyborg ex-Nazi assassin. Did I miss anything? And waiting in the wings, the stomach-turning menace of the Hurler. All this plus Supreme, still only $1.95. Hey, my nipples are getting hard just thinking about it. about it. So in that issue, Trencher is able to kill Chernobyl, repossess her, but he's blown in half. And so his body gets sent to the morgue and he slowly stitches himself back together. It takes about a day for him to get his body back into line again. It may be very reminiscent of Lobo's Back, where the same thing happens to Lobo. Mm-hmm. He's blown in half, goes to heaven and hell, and finally brings himself back together again. You can definitely see some very strong similarities in terms of the DNA for that.
So
he gets himself back together. He goes to the American Southwest. He fights this hurler guy. He basically has superhuman vomiting abilities. You're starting to see a pattern emerging here, I'm sure. In pursuit of killing the hurler, he also fights this cactus-themed villain who's a Southwest superhero. Legions of inferior superheroes running around in this thing. While he's in the American Southwest, he runs afoul of Supreme. And that happens mostly in the third issue, so let me read the solicit copy on that one. More reasonably affordable mayhem as Gideon clashes head-on with the one and only Supreme. That's right, it's the battle of the receding hairlines when Supreme decides to put Trencher back on that big old unemployment line in the sky. You'll never forgive yourself if you miss this one. Come to think of it, neither will we. He has this issue-long, somewhat silent fight with Supreme. Somehow, his big old gun manages to actually make Supreme bleed several times, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me because of how powerful Supreme is. If he can do that to Supreme, I don't understand why he's having issues with Chernobyls and hurlers and nasal pythons and shit. Supreme beats the shit out of Trencher, essentially literally knocks his block off, knocks his head off. Trencher has to hide in this other dimensional limbo. I don't remember what it was called, but apparently it tied into Alan Moore's 1963 because he gave it an acknowledgement. And while he's there, he runs into Golden Age Trencher, who's got his own Trenchermobile, and it's basically like more of a proper superhero. And the Gideon character can't stand that Trencher, but he has to tolerate him while he's hiding out from Supreme. So there apparently are other Trenchers, but we haven't seen any present in our present day. This guy is from an earlier period. Trencher comes back to Earth, and that leads into the fourth and final issue. Let me read you the copy on that one. Meet Nigel P. Ripperton, the world's smallest Elvis impersonator and self-proclaimed entrepreneurial genius behind the Don't We Just Love Elvis to Pieces traveling review. So what has all this got to do with Trencher? Hey, buy the book to find out. What do we look like here? Cliff Notes? That issue of Trencher, it's cute because it's a playoff of Reign of Superman, but instead of them being Superman, they're Elvis impersonators. Elvis's soul has been divided into four different bodies, just like what happened in Reign of Superman, theoretically. That was the theory at the time. We found out later on that wasn't the case. Eradicator Elvis, there's a cyborg Elvis, there's a giant robot Elvis is like Steel, there's baby Elvis. And that's where we find out that Gideon draws a line of killing kids. So there's still a quarter of Elvis still alive in the Image universe because he would not kill baby Elvis, but he killed all the other ones. Okay. Seemed like he was going to use Nigel P. Ripperton, this little person Elvis impersonator, was going to be maybe a recurring character, it seemed like maybe, but the book ended. Here's the solicitation copy for Trencher number 5 that was never released.
Okay.
And I don't know if it ever got produced, but one of the things that is interesting about Trencher is the solicitation copy on Trencher is accurate. Each issue, the information is correct. So I don't know if Giffen just stuck to what his intentions were or if he'd actually done the material before he released it. Trencher number 4 was the last issue produced by Image. And
I saw that,
anything else out. This book could actually exist somewhere. I'd like to ask him about that. So the solicitation copy on number 5, which also I believe features art that I hadn't seen anywhere else by Giffen. It says, the small town of Raven's Roost has a secret, a dark secret that lurks behind the town's picture postcard facade. And if the town folk all look a bit too perfect and men too uniformly handsome, the women too consistently beautiful, just chalk it up to clean living. Oh, and about that almost palpable feeling of dread? Try not to let it spoil your stay. Guess where we're sending Gideon this month? And you'll be guessing for the next 30 years because the shit never came out. Image had decided that they were wanting to expand their operations. They wanted to bring in more creators, and they also wanted people who were going to fill the gaps in their publishing schedule since they weren't getting books out on a regular basis. And so they extended their invitations to more veteran talents, including Keith Giffen.
Image would just take a small percentage for the work that they had done in terms of production and their office, and you got the rest. Trencher was killed when they decided to kill all the second tier books.
The Trencher book was not particularly well received, and like many of his cohorts in this initiative, Image decided to cancel all these books in progress. The fifth issue of Trencher was produced. My understanding is it does exist. I've seen pages from it. It was supposed to come out from Image, and I think there's some kind of contract where it was having to come back out at Image, and yet at the same time, Image didn't want to publish it. So my understanding is that issue exists, and it's out there, and we may never see it. Because Boom, actually, I think it was Boom, did a collection of Trencher a few years back, probably a lot of few years back now I think about it, and it only collected the 4 issues, which doesn't make sense because that wasn't all of the Trencher material that was produced, and it wasn't even all the Trencher material that was published, but they just collected the first 4 issues. But there's some reason why that would be the case. Trencher number 1 was released on May the 11th, 1993. It was the 200th best-selling comic of 1993. Like, for the entire year, it was number 200.
Out of how many books?
Thousands. Many tens of thousands of books. It was the 68th best-selling Image comic of 1993. So if you took all the Image comics that came out the year when they were at their biggest, it was 68. It was outsold by the Image Swimsuit Special, Super Patriot number 1, and the Wildcat Source Book, but it outsold ongoing issues of Cyberforce, Shadowhawk, and Vanguard number 1. So, not terrible, but for number 1, it didn't do that great either. Only number 1 ranked in the top 300 comics of 1993. 1993, for instance. Trencher number 2 came out June 15th, 1993. May, June, we actually have a monthly book here. July 27th, slipped a little bit, but still on schedule. And then there was a several month gap because Keith Giffen produced the first three issues of Jim Valentino's Images of Shadowhawk. So the first issue of that came out September 13th, 1993. And then finally, Trencher number 4 came out October the 11th, 1993. So a month after that first Images of Shadowhawk issue. In August 1993 sales, it was ranked 83rd in unit sales, 79th in dollar sales. It was the 18th of 21 Image comics produced that month in terms of its ranking on sales. It was ahead of 1963 and Stupid, but behind Supreme. Oh, wow. It ranked number 37. Okay. So the Images of Shadowhawk issues buoyed it a little bit. The second issue came out October 25th, so just a few weeks after Trencher number 4. The third issue had a big gap, though. It went from October to January 24th, 1994. The November 1993 sales ranking, it was number 39 in unit sales, number 47 in dollar sales. So the Images of Shadowhawk issues, the last issue of that, did better than most any true issue of Trencher ever did, just by virtue of being tied into Shadowhawk. It was also the 14th ranked Image title of that particular month. So what do you think of the Trencher character that you've seen him? What do you think of the concept?
I mean, it's just Lobo.
I think there's a little bit of Hellboy in there too.
Yeah, for the most part, it's just, it felt to me like it was Lobo in a trench coat with a little bit of martial law mixed in for weirdness. I mean, I like the style.
I think it's a really cool premise. I like the idea of him being like an agent of heaven who's repossessing souls. I think there's a lot of potential in that.
I feel like I've read that already, though.
He's constantly talking to a female voice in his head that he calls Phoebe that basically helps direct his actions. And I think it was in the Infanticide miniseries where they introduced a hairdresser who also worked as a side gig of, she would assign bounty hunters the job. And so it really does feel like a self-swipe. Keith Giffen has said many times how much he hates Lobo and how he only ever seems to work on the character under duress. And yet, Trencher, who he loves, wondering if he hates Lobo more because this was probably the biggest creation of his career that he gave to DC. And so instead of having it for himself, he gave it to DC and DC went wild with it and he doesn't get to get any. I'm wondering if that's what it is. I mean, yeah, Lobo's a detestable character, but if you read the Trencher series, Trencher Gideon does a lot of fucked up stuff and has a complete disregard for human life. Aside from him, he's not sadistic. He's just careless and unconcerned and completely lacking of empathy. He's just not sadistic. The sadism is really the only major difference between the two characters, it seems like. And that he's not self-motivated like Lobo is. Lobo actually enjoys going off on his adventures and the money is just a bonus.
Yeah.
Where with Gideon, he's doing the job because he has to do the job and he doesn't actually enjoy what he's doing. That's the only other major difference, it seems like. I definitely didn't enjoy it when I was reading it at the time, but looking at it today with fresh eyes, I really respect that Giffen was willing to go so far out there with his style. Giffen is sort of like the Brad Pitt of comics. He hooks up with somebody who's accomplished and then he starts to morph into a semblance of them. When he was doing Defenders, he was at his heaviest Jack Kirby influence. When he worked on Legion of Superheroes ahead of the reboot, he had a very strong Kevin Maguire influence because he was working with Maguire on Justice League International. And I strongly think that Trencher happened in part because he worked with Simon Bisley, and Bisley has this very energetic style where he draws directly into ink.
Damn.
And in the case of Bisley, not only did he have the command of the pen so that he could pull that off and not have it look like shit, but, you know, it had a real energy to it. You know, it just moved in a way that his painted work didn't move. And I think that maybe from talking with Bisley, Giffen was inspired to try to do the same thing.
That's kind of cool.
Laverne Kinzierski colored this book.
Well, if coloring, that was Laverne Kinzierski. That's his headache.
He deserves all the accolades in the world because when you look at the raw black and white artwork, trying to turn that into something that's in color and have it make sense had to be a challenge. And I've seen a few other people color Trencher, and nobody can color Trencher correctly except for Laverne Kinzierski. He's the only one who can make that art make sense.
It's ugly.
It's hard to interpret it, but it's very interesting, ornate artwork. It's not necessarily to my taste, but I respect a lot more now than I was able to back in the 90s when he didn't look like Jim Lee and I was put off by that. The stories, I don't get off on the whole goofy supervillain thing. I really don't get off on the scatological quality of it. I don't find humor in farts and shit and vomit and all that kind of shit. That was a total turn off for me. I still think with a scripter, it might have worked okay. Keith Giffen has written stuff on his own since Trencher and some of that stuff's been okay, but I don't think that he can get the words on the page quite as well without help. I think he needs the synergy of a collaborator, very much like Jack Kirby. I was listening to a panel review that Alan Moore did fairly recently. It was weird seeing Alan Moore on a contemporary panel, considering how much this guy seems to hate conventions and legions of fans in front of him. But he was talking about Stan Lee wanted to meet him, I think it was.
I saw that one.
You saw the same one?
Yeah, where he's in front of a mic.
Yeah.
Like just sitting at a simple table.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You remember what he was saying?
Oh, no, no. Well, you go. No, I saw this like 2 weeks ago. He didn't like Stan Lee.
No.
I was shocked.
He said Stan Lee's a nice enough guy and stuff, but that he had come to the conclusion that all these artists had written these stories and that Stan Lee had taken a massively disproportionate amount of credit where he may not have deserved any credit as far as Alan Moore was concerned, because in his mind, Jack Kirby had written those stories.
Yeah.
And Stan Lee had no business inserting himself. And this is an age-old argument. Read Jack Kirby's books when he writes his own books, and read the books when Stan Lee does it. And Alan Moore acknowledged that Stan Lee wrote some snappy dialogue and then gave him no credit for the stories at all. But what he seemed to forget is that the artist would come into Marvel, and Stan and the artist would talk about what the story was going to be that month. Mm-hmm. He didn't type out plots and stuff. He'd basically sit there and talk with the artist about what he was looking for in the book and what the book needed and so on and so forth.
Well, hold on. He didn't just talk. He would act it out.
Jump on the tables. Everybody talks about that. Yeah. He'd basically act out these big, crazy stories, and the artist would interpret that into an actual panel-to-panel thing. Mm-hmm. And that in no way diminishes what those artists did, and it does in no way banishes what those writers did, because you have to write a story to get panels onto a page.
Yeah.
You can't just tell somebody the story and then have them go draw it.
Superman is there.
Right. You even if you're going there and doing your little stage
motivation,
play or whatever.
Some kind of motivation.
Yeah, in order to tell a story from panel to panel, you're a writer, because you have to, you're a director, however you want to look at it. Contributing to the storytelling to a degree that is greater than just being the illustrator of somebody else's story. In no way discount that. However, not only do I feel like Stanley was contributing to those plots, because those artists did not plot as well without him typically, and the stories they told were different than the stories they told while they worked with Stan, but that dialogue made a huge difference in us being able to connect to those characters.
So you didn't agree with Alan Moore?
I agree that he has every right to hate Stan Lee, and Jack Kirby has every right to hate Stan Lee, because he definitely grotesquely diminished the contributions of the writer slash artists that he worked with.
Yeah.
However, I don't think the books were the same without Stan Lee, and I think that Keith Giffen here, scripting for himself, is in dire need of a scripter, because without a writer to help to interpret his visual language, his characters, so that you could understand them and hook into them, the Trencher just doesn't work. He needs a scripter to get those characters across. The humor that he's using in there isn't funny, and I know he has to be capable of humor, because Robert Orrin Fleming really isn't funny without Keith Giffen. James DeMatteis, I'm sorry, I love the guy, I don't really find his stuff funny when he's not working with Keith Giffen. It's like the two of them together are great. When Giffen has tried to be funny on his own, when I've read that, it hasn't really done it for me. I know Keith Giffen's a funny guy, but without somebody else to help him with the jokes, to punch up the jokes, Trencher is not a funny book. So that's why I'm focusing on the serious stuff. Like, I think it's a cool premise. I love the look of Trencher. In some respects, nobody else can draw Trencher besides Keith Giffen. The few people who have tried, it looks pretty bad. But at times, I kind of wish somebody else would draw him, because Trencher looked cooler when he's not done that style. You can see like the basics there, kind of like Lobo.
Mm-hmm.
Lobo looks cooler drawn by Simon Disley than he looks drawn by Keith Giffen. And Simon Disley did draw Trencher for some of the Black Ball comics, and it looked cool. The weird, slimy, orangey, peachy streaks he's got through his hair. It's such a unique... Nobody has peach streaks through their hair, you know? And yeah, there is some stuff there that's highly derivative. He does owe a lot to Lobo, and I think also to Hellboy. But I think there's enough there that you could actually do something really cool with it. And at one point, he was actually writing a screenplay for Trencher, and I could see this translating to an interesting movie, the premise. But I hope somebody worked on the script with him as well. At one point, too, he wanted to have something done with Bloodstrike. They inferred that he was going to get tied into Spawn and Bloodstrike, which makes perfect sense since they're seem to be in a similar concept space. And none of that ever came about. And I really mourn for the possibilities of those team-ups.
Now, when comic book writers write, do they go with the first script they write?
Not always. It depends. I think most of the time they do, because most comics, especially historically, were written on the fly, and we got to grind out these pages and get this book out and make our money. But in recent years, I do think you probably had some drafts. I know one thing we talked about was like Frank Miller on Dark Knight Returns went through many drafts before you had what came up on the page. And I think that's much more common now to go through multiple drafts before you get to the finished comic. But generally speaking, yeah, you basically publish the first draft.
Because I was following this guy who talks about comics, and he kind of breaks down and he says that, and I never really noticed it, but he said, have you ever noticed when you read a story arc, there's certain arcs you really enjoy and there's some that you're just like, huh? And he says, you know, because he's been in the industry, and he says usually those huh issues are first drafts. Like, they literally just wrote it and drew it and pumped it out, where the other ones went through multiple drafts. Like, the artist or the writer might have come up with a story 6 months ago, jotted it down, touched it up. Okay, I got three issues here I want to do. So I was kind of interested. I was kind of curious if a lot of writers, if it was on the fly, like you said, or did they have time to work on their scripts? Because this one felt like just pump it out.
I don't think it was pumped out. I think it was just that he needed an interpreter. He needed somebody to write dialogue that would make you connect to the character better and the concepts better. So. Okay, and now the follow-up episode.
What follow-up?
My thing, though, is Spawn Armor is like the one show where we consistently get reader feedback and we consistently acknowledge it. And to my recollection, I might have forgotten one, but to my recollection, every episode we've done so far has been you and me doing the listener feedback. I just don't feel right about doing one without you. And I know most of the time I'm just talking at you. I know that. But even when I bring other people on the show, it's you and me at the beginning. It's you and me at the end. It's kind of our show. And I just don't feel right doing one of these without you.
Oh, I appreciate it, man. I feel loved. Yeah, let's go.
For our Tumblr blog for the episode 21 Youngblood Yearbook, Bush 007 liked and reblogged us. The Tumblr for episode 25 was liked by Flare Joe, Franjo Gutierrez Art, S Seals 618, Supreme Being 24, and it was reblogged by Flare Joe. On Facebook, our last episode was liked by Derek William Crabb and Paolo Marquez Jr. And then on Twitter, our bread and butter, we got attention from the 20th Century Geek podcast, the 108th Sage, Adriano, Andrea Rica, Dr. Ange, Baby Skeletor, Biko Django, Bill at Philly Spider 85, Boss Taylor, Brian Gonsalves, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, Comic Book Couples Counseling, Drew at 9Boxer9, Dr. Pop Culture BGSU, aka Chuck Coletta, Do Terrifically Better, Ed Moore at Teal Productions, Fanholes Podcast, Green Lantern HG Fighting the Good Fight, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, Hayden of Zur in R, History of Comics on Film, Inferno Spider Crash, I Was Joe Crawford, Jason Schmidt, Jason Snicked Venable, Jeffrey Brown, Jock Tastico, Keith G. Baker, Christados, Mike at Send Aliens to Me, Miracle Man at Komodo 1977, Odell Admiral Dracula, Rad Adventures Podcasting Network, Relatively Geeky, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Richard Field, Richard G., Schlocktopus Inc., Siskoid, Sofon Comics, Sue Kent Ant, Talk Nerdy to Me, Tim Price the Podcrasher, Tuck, X51, Aaron Stack Comic, Xenozoic Xenophiles, and Zendal 42. Baby Skeletor wrote, Grew, Grit, and Gore, All a Growing Man-Child Needs in Life. Chris Dunford wrote, Gonna Be a Good One. Jeffrey Brown wrote, Extreme Studios Going Gonzo Gore, Grindhouse Ultraviolence. Oh, I am well aware of the death of Chapel by way of a Linkara episode where he covers the series. I'm glad that on the HBO show they didn't kill Chapel like Liefeld did in this issue of Youngblood. It's kind of why I like that version over the comic one a little bit. So question number one, have you ever watched any of Linkara stuff?
No, what is that?
It's a dude who wears a hat and glasses. He does a series called, I think, Atop the Fourth Wall, where he basically will do the kind of stuff we do, but he did it years before us, where he takes a random issue of a comic book and shits all over it, mostly.
Okay.
Second, would you have preferred Chapel's fate be more like the TV show or like the comics?
Mm. Well, see, I haven't seen the TV show yet.
The Spawn TV show?
Yeah, I've only watched the first season.
You never watched the other two seasons? I could have sworn you watched those like when they first came out.
No, dude, they came out, what, 20-some years ago?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that you went home and you'd watch it with Pussycat and shit.
I've seen a lot of animation since then.
Personally, I have to wait and see what's going to happen with Chapel in the material that follows his suicide, and I'll get back with you. But I've never read any of that stuff, so I don't know how I'm going to react to it. Back to the letter. But Bloodstrike is like everything that DC Suicide Squad could have been if they leaned into the 80s Screaming Mad George, Brian Yuzna type gore, which was a nice pull there. If Bloodstrike was a movie made in the late 80s, early 90s, Fife really captured that. It's the opposite of Wildstorm, which is, you know, fair. Tag is an interesting character in this series. Well, there is what she does for R&R, so that's chilling in an 80s horror movie level. A little bit of what Cronenberg or Clive Barker would have done. And then you have Chapel on this team is very unstable. Kinda wish that HBO could have done a Bloodstrike animated series as a double feature to Spawn, since Chapel appeared on that show a lot. Yeah, right? Agreed.
Or spinoff.
Also, what animation team you think could have worked on this animated series if it ever got made in the 90s? I was trying to think about that. For me, I'm not a big animation guy, so I'd have trouble with that, but somebody like Peter Chung would have been pretty cool, I think, to give it a little bit more of an intellect. I love
this team that did the Men in Black cartoon or even the Rusty and Big Guy cartoon, that animation style it's simple but detailed. Yeah, but you're right. It would have been a kind of a cool Suicide Squad type story.
Yeah, yeah.
So was Bloodstrike their version of Suicide Squad that just doesn't die?
That's what Jeffrey Brown is alluding to. I wouldn't go there.
That's a very good point. I never thought about that. It kind of loses the fun where you can hate this character from Suicide Squad and they die. Didn't you recommend it to me to read the Ostrander stuff?
Oh, sure. Given, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Someone gave me a trade and I started kind of peeking at it and I'm like, okay, this is cool. I'm kind of digging this. It's dark, but not too, too dark. So,
well, and you got to.
I think I've read like one or two issues so far.
You got to give it a little length too, because it is an 80s book and it was doing some stuff that hadn't really been done with the comics before. So it takes a little while to really get traction. So, I mean, hopefully you would get into it with the first trade, but it might actually take a couple of trades to really start to get the flavor of the book.
Well, I'm a big fan of you take the fuck ups, you put them in a team and you put them in a fucked up situation.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like those story arcs. That's why I Like the Boys and those type characters. So Suicide Squad, I've never really read it. I've tried to read some of the new stuff and I was kind of like, eh.
The simple fact that whenever I have seen a Suicide Squad book come out since about 2011, it always seems to be the same batch of characters. And that reminds me of X-Men, you know, when they did the Jim Lee series, the big 8 million copy series.
Yeah.
And that was the point where they had a stable X-Men team for years and years. The same people were on the same teams. And a big part of the appeal of X-Men was you'd cycle characters in and out of the book. It was always evolving. It was always changing up the flavors, mixing things up. And with Suicide Squad, everybody dies or quit because they don't want to die on a freaking mission. And you'll have a few people that stick around that are maybe the core, but everybody around them is always changing. And even the core people will often go off and do stuff for long periods of time. And so when you've got the same guys for year after year, I know they're screwing up the premise, because if you have to have Harley Quinn in every adventure, if you have to have Deadshot, that's not what you're reading a book like that for. I would have liked to have seen a Bloodstrike spinoff cartoon. I think it's really insightful. I hadn't really considered it, but I do like the Wildstorm universe, and there is, you know, we will eventually get to Wildstorm. It's just that since Extreme is so much more closely tied to the Spawn than Wildstorm, we kind of have to do the Extreme stuff. But I think one of the reasons why I like Extreme more than average people, because I'm a horror guy too, and I love the mingling of superheroes and horror, which a lot of people don't like. And so probably that's part of why I like Extreme, is because they do play around with a lot of gore and horror stuff that isn't as commonly seen in other superhero universes.
Wait, when Stormwatch got wiped out by aliens, was that part of Image still, or?
Yes, it was still an Image, but you remember too, that being in Wildstorm was something of a turning point, because Wildstorm didn't go that dark or that brutal that often. It really started with Alan Moore.
Brutal.
Yeah, that was Warren Ellis. I think that Warren Ellis sort of brought an Extreme mentality into Wildstorm, because certainly the liberties that Mark Miller took with the Authority afterwards were more in the vein of the kind of stuff that Alan Moore was pulling on the Extreme universe before that, and Keith Giffen was doing a lot of that type of stuff that was introduced into Wildstorm by Ellis and Miller later on. So I think that maybe the Extreme stuff of the earlier 90s was sort of the beta test for what the British writers and creators were going to do with Wildstorm in the late 90s and early 2000s. Jeffrey had also suggested the people who did the Max show on MTV Oddities. I don't know if it was a comparison of what they could have done, or if he actually wanted the people who were involved with that to do the Bloodstrike stuff. He also said, I doubt that we would ever have gotten Bloodstrike, Youngblood, Supreme animated series that we could ever see these plot lines in motion, both with Andrew Rev and Terrific Productions holding the IP hostage and being a jackass, not paying his artist, or many other sins. We will never see it. And that's true. Nobody wants anything to do with Andrew Rev. But I also think it's funny that we almost got that Youngblood cartoon on CBS. And I really do like the animation from the Roundabout short that Liefeld leaked a while back. But it is funny to me too. New on CBS Saturday mornings, a government wetworks assassin with AIDS. You know, it's a whoremonger. Buy the action figure from Playmates Toys. You know, I was like, what? I'm really surprised that it even got as far as it did. So
that's true.
Yeah. So the Abdullah Abner Dracula wrote today's dollar bin purchases, and he sent us a picture of a bunch of, I think it was mostly Youngblood stuff and Strike Files. Just another example of the bad influences all the Pouches and Image Comics podcast and Rolled Spine Spawnometer have had on my once exemplary tastes. But all that Bloodstrike talk led me to issues 1 through 3 of Copra 2, so maybe it's okay. He also questioned our warning at the beginning of the episode that it contained nudity. But actually, our Image gallery did contain male nudity and a little bit of almost female nudity, so it still kind of applies. Whereas Naked as Audio gets without going into the full OnlyFans experience as suggested by Mac. Oh, and speaking of which, Kyle Benning ended it with, you guys making millions of dollars off that shit like all of those Russian Twitter bots are. Now, we don't even make Fire and Water podcast money around here. You know, those guys are balling compared to us.
I concur.
Those guys are making, I shouldn't say making, because they do like a podcast every single day. They got Patreon patrons who were paying them like $400 a month to help keep that stuff going. And I don't know how much it's costing them to support, you know, that the kind of traffic and downloads that they've got. But apparently it was at the point where they were about ready to shut down. They may need $400 a month in hosting fees alone.
Hey, if people want to send me money, I am so down for that. Just saying.
Well, thankfully, we're not popular enough to need any material support from anybody. So far, nobody has passed a hat to us yet, because there aren't enough people who give a shit about Rolled Spine Podcast to put that kind of strain on us.
I think we are setting the foundation for Rolled Spine with this Spawnometer.
You think this is going to be the one that really breaks us through to where somebody is making us pay them to support us?
Oh, yeah. We'll be hobnobbing with McFarlane in no time. I'll be like, Todd, let me get some of those new figures you keep pumping out, man. Come on.
Hey everybody, I'm Joe.
And I'm Sean.
And we have a pro wrestling podcast we want to tell you about. It's called I Could Talk Kayfabe.
That's right, we're looking at the wrestling magazines from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, breaking them down and having some fun.
Do you want to know who was the number one rated wrestler in March of 1986?
Do you want to know why Rick Rude is wrestling the Ultimate Warrior all wrong?
Maybe you want to hear about a brutal ladder match between Colonel DeBeers and Scott Hall.
Or how about an interview with Mike Rotundo? There's a lot of them.
And lots of cool photos of Butch Reed and Al Perez.
Check us out wherever you get your podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Apple Podcasts. Rate, subscribe, and tell a friend.
You pencil neck geek.
And welcome everybody to what?
Wait, Brian, what are you doing?
Oh yeah, that's right. We're supposed to be recording a promo here, aren't we?
Aren't you supposed to tell people where they can find us?
Yeah, we're What the Hops Podcast, based out of Buffalo, New York. We like to talk a lot about beer.
A little bit about music.
And all sorts of random things.
So be sure to go find us wherever you get your podcasts and hit up all your social medias and search What the Hops and hit that like button.
Cheers.
It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
Hello, Podcast Land, and welcome to the Radioactive Lounge. I am one of your hosts for this wonderful new odyssey. My name is Lucas Testro, and with me today,
Larry Boxall.
And we're sitting in the beautiful surrounds, All-Star Comics.
Level 1410 Lonsdale Street in Melbourne, surrounded by all the lovely comic books.
And the lovely comic book people, hopefully.
Yes.
We're going to record it live, Laz and me, and a different guest every month, who might be a creator, or it might just be someone, just one of our favourite funny people.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about the world of comics. Friday night drinks, but for comics.
Perfect.
Just come in, loosen your tie, hang out with us while we talk about comic books.
Yeah.
We should tell you where you can reach us if you haven't found us already. Look up Radioactive Lounge on Facebook. You can also find us on Twitter at @RadLounge. And we have an email address that I just remembered today that we have that I haven't been looking at if anyone's bothered.
Very exciting.
RadioactiveLounge@gmail.com.
And also, if you're in town, you should come by and
come,
say hello.
That's the better situation.
That's much just, better. Yeah.
Get on mic. It's going to be like when I was a boy watching Hey Hey It's Saturday, and then they would go over, and it'd get to like 11 o'clock, and it's still going. And it'd be so exciting because you go, oh my God, like, yeah. You know, Channel 9's super important late night Saturday night lineup's clearly being disrupted here. Hopefully, we'll see you there. It's going to be fun times.
Yes.
See you later.
Bye.
This is a fan produced, not for profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!